I've always been an animal lover. Ever since I saw a picture of a dog, I've been like, I want that. I still love and respect animals, but as a kid, it was pretty intense, not gonna lie. Can we get a dog? Can we get a dog? Can we get a dog? My parents had to sit through years of that until my dad finally couldn't handle it anymore and got me one for my 7th birthday against my mom's will. Before that, they tried everything to make me stop, besides getting me a dog. And by everything, I mean a bunch of fish. Maybe if we shape these fish into a dog, she won't notice. They'd come home with 2 fish from the pet store that would last for about a week, die, and then get replaced. Repeat until dog appears. How many fish must die before I get what I want? Since we got fish from the pet store and not an actual breeder, that was probably a big contributing factor on why they died so quickly. But as a 5-year-old, I also just forgot to feed them a lot, so there's gotta be some fish blood on my hands for that. We went through probably 20 fish in the span of a couple months, but eventually we got these 2 goldfish that didn't die. A true miracle. They were pretty resilient little dudes. One was Goldie, and the other was probably named Fishy. Probably some of the most creatively flawless names I've ever known. But after a while, Goldie turned white, so I renamed it Rainbow because I thought it was cool he could change colors. I learned 13 years later from my marine biology teacher that Goldie/Rainbow was probably diseased, which makes the color change less exciting. We eventually gave them away to my mom's friend and they died. But that's all besides the point. My parents got me an army of fish and a dog I named Scruffy, but that was it. I wasn't able to crack them any further than that. And believe me, I tried. My parents had to become stone-faced, emotionless soldiers to keep my non-stop beseeching for more creatures at bay. After they got me a dog, I was pretty sad satisfied for about 1.5 years until I decided I wanted a mouse. Something about their cute little faces and how they crawl with their cute little feet and their freaking ears made me obsess over having one, and my parents got to hear all about it. I asked my parents for a mouse for years, promising how I'd take care of it and blah 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 the whole thing. My mom pretty much hates rodents because she thinks their tails are weird, so there was no budging on that one. She tried to get me to stop by saying, "Alright, you can get a mouse, but we'd have to get rid of Scruffy." Which is obviously a bad bang for your buck. No, what? No, no way, nuh-uh. I'd never get rid of Scruffy, he's my pal for life. But not gonna lie, after hearing that response over 10 times, I started kinda considering it. I wasn't ever actually gonna do it. I was just getting desperate, alright? When I was 10, I wrote on my Christmas wish list that I wanted a mouse because I thought for some reason I'd foiled their plans and found a loophole. Ha! You can't override the power of the holy Christmas spirit. Christmas morning rolled around and I ran into the living room where all the presents were to not only find no mouse, but a computer mouse. Nice salt in the wound there, Mom. I got my hopes up way too high. My disappointment was immeasurable and my Christmas was ruined. I did get a computer though, so that was cool. After my parents endured 5 years of me asking for a mouse, I read this book series called Maximum Ride, which was about these teenagers who had bird wings and were on the run to not get captured by the scientists who wanted to keep experimenting on them. It was my favorite book series as a kid, and it made me really like birds, which resulted in the next animal obsession. I swear to God, if I hear one more mention of a mouse again, I'm gonna-
Mom, can we get a yellow-naped Amazon parrot?
Yes, I started loving birds back when I was in 6th grade. Everyone say a big thanks to James Patterson for creating this bird-obsessed monster. At the time, I wanted one of the big boy birds. A yellow-naped Amazon parrot, to be exact. I would spend hours just watching all the YouTube videos I could find of them and sending them to my parents like, "Look! Look how great they are! You totally want one now, don't you, after watching one play in a box and sing Old MacDonald?" This was a whole new type of fixation. I mapped out on the ground where the cage could go with tape, googled where Amazon parrot breeders were near me. I made multiple PowerPoint presentations for my parents on why they should let me get a parrot. It was intense, and the pressure was on. My mom was even like, "So how about that mouse?" But no, Mom, that ship has sailed. Now I want a 15-inch parrot that lives for 80 years. They started telling me, "You can get a bird when you move out." And from then on, it was my goal to get out of my parents' house as soon as I could. Obviously, I never got a yellow-naped Amazon parrot, but I never really got out of my bird phase because I've got this thickums right here. I was pretty self-aware that asking for a parrot was a long shot, so even though I still wanted a bird, I dialed back my animal requests, and when I was 14, I started really liking flying squirrels. They were my favorite animal for a while, and that's when I realized people can have them as pets. Sugar gliders.
Mom, can we-
Sugar glider, add that one to the list. I don't think I actually bothered my parents too much about getting flying squirrels as much as the mouse and parrot, but I know they knew I wanted one. And I knew they were gonna say no. So I guess I just kept that one a bit more internal. During the summer, we would visit my family in Canada, and my cousin Peyton was really obsessed with ferrets at the time. So we would spend literally entire days on the computers together, researching ferrets and flying squirrels, and Amazon parrots, because they were still my number one obsession, lest not forget. We wrote down general facts we learned in Word documents, planned out how to care for them, added up how much money they cost, including cages, food, bedding, etc., etc. We were the same amount of obsessed. It was a lot of fun, actually. We bonded a lot during those times, and she's still one of my best friends. She also never got a ferret, so sad times there. Peyton also got a rat named Lola, and that made me really want a rat. Which, of course, meant...
Mom!
Lola was so sweet and smart, and I always wanted to play with her. But that's also true with almost anyone's pets. If I come over to your house and you have any type of pet, I will be personally offended if you don't let me play with it for at least 3 hours. So I did have a small point where I was asking if my parents would let me have a rat, and my mom was like, nope, and I'd be all, but what about the time you were gonna let me get a mouse because I was asking for a parrot? And she would say, nope, that ship has sailed. Touché, mother. During 10th grade, I was also starting to really like raccoons. I thought they were sneaky and cool, and I googled if people had them as pets as a random, not serious thought. But surprise, surprise, some people do have raccoon pets. Just kidding, they rip up couches and dig holes in walls, and I'm not that devoted to raccoons. But I still dreamed about having a raccoon buddy someday. Finally, I graduated from high school and moved into a dorm in college that didn't allow pets, which was torture for me. I waited all this time to move out, and I'm still not able to bring a horde of mice, rats, birds, sugar gliders, and maybe a raccoon into the rooms. But YouTube started kicking off shortly after, and I moved back in with my parents to pursue that. Flash forward a bit, and I was finally able to get Ari. After 10 years of wanting a bird, I'd finally done it. And what a gander he is. Was he worth the wait? No, he's a dumb bird. You're good. You're a good bird. I'm not currently looking to get any more animals right now, even though I really want them. I have Ari, and he's already enough of a handful, so I can't commit to anything else right now. I am gonna get a dog eventually, that's a promise. And I do really like reptiles, so I've done my fair share of research on skinks, but that's only a 30% chance to actually happen. I haven't really grown out of my animal phase. I've just become a mix of that and my parents, still hopelessly entranced by creatures, but also being the one who has to tell myself no because I have other stupid responsibilities. Hopefully when I have kids, they won't be as animal obsessed as I am, because I don't think I have the strength my parents had to be able to say no to any animals they ask for. Thank God my parents were responsible and never got me animals just because I asked for them. Otherwise, I'd be living in a zoo. Now, I know you guys, and this is absolutely gonna trigger a bombardment of tweets to me with pictures of the pets you have, and all I can say to that is... bring it on. It took a while, but the Ari bags and a lot of other new things are now being sold on the shop, so you might be interested in some of that. I'm sorry it took a while to get finished, but I hope you like the stuff. That's all I want to say for now. Yeah, bye.
Hey, just wanted to mention you can buy our new Jaden anime figure bundle on jadenanimations.com. Cool, thank you.
Game shows. People's favorite way to fantasize about how to win a lot of money and look really cool in front of the entire country. Everyone has sat down in front of a good old Deal or No Deal and watched the middle-aged white people pick the obvious wrong cases while Howie Mandel just smiles. And if you were on that show, you could do so much better because lucky case number 24 has never let you down. Well, today I'm gonna live that fantasy and prove how easy it is to actually win money on game shows. With my friends Jordan and Kelsey, we're gonna simulate three of America's favorite game shows and see how much money we can collectively win. Let's see how hypothetically rich we could have gotten. The first game we tried was Family Feud. 90% of you guys know Family Feud, and I see you, but for the ones who don't, the show asks 100 random people survey questions, and you have to guess what their most common answers are to get points. I thought this was gonna be easy. Steve Harvey sets you up with a dirty question, you scream naked grandma, and then they give you money. But the moment this poser of a host walked out, I knew I was out of my element.
The Ari Tofu family
up against the Ari Tofus. Let's play Family Feud.
That's not Steve Harvey. The game lets you build your family, and I was just gonna make me and my two birds, Ari and Tofu, and randomize the last two members. Looking back, I probably should have just made Jordan and Kelsey because they were right there. But somehow the game randomized to Walter White, so we just kind of went with it.
You can see them, like, the stretching.
Walter White!
That's Walter White! It's really him.
That's good.
Look, it's so good.
The prompt we were given first was, name a president whose face appears on money, to which we buzzed in Lincoln, and the opposing family, the Hortons, answered Roosevelt. And America must have been thinking the same thing I was, which was, wait, Roosevelt is on money? Because we got the higher score and got to keep guessing more answers. We very confidently punched in Washington, which was first, and then realized we didn't have any more guesses. Obama? After three strikes of wrong answers, the Hortons buzzed Hamilton, which is stupid because Alexander Hamilton wasn't even a president to begin with. Everyone who experienced 2015 knows that.
Does that mean they steal all the points?
No. Hamilton.
Well, like Alexander.
It's time for you to score some points.
If I know something, Hamilton is not a president.
Like the Graham Bell? Alexander Graham Bell?
They took all the points! BS! Name a president. Alexander Hamilton. Ding, 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 ding. Here's all the points. America is so dense and uneducated, they are literally pumping wrong answers into Family Feud, and I am suffering because of it. Name a fruit. Hot dog. Going into round two, we were down just a bit at 0 points to 96, but we swept the next prompt. Something that helps a baby go to sleep. Milk. Round three, hit the fan again. Something you might lose as you get older. We were on a roll with hair, teeth, memory, hearing, and memory. We got a strike because I said parents, and even though that's literally 100% correct, guaranteed, it wasn't on there. There was one answer left we needed to figure out, and we came up with vision, which we were very confident in, but received another strike. Flabbergasted. How is hearing on there, but not vision? We threw out a half-assed walking, got our last strike, and it was given to the Hortons. Strangely enough, they ended up passing. Guess they couldn't think of anything. But you know what the answer was revealed to be? Eyesight. America is so lucky the Hortons passed on answering, because if they answered eyesight and took all our points again after we said vision, it would have started my villain arc. With a strong point lead of 224 to 96, we are now entering a double points round. What's something people alphabetize? Names. Soup. Four Americans thought they were being funny in the Family Feud surveys, and I am yet again suffering because of it. So the Hortons can play, but they end up passing again for some reason. That family only alphabetizes soup. We tried music, children, we ran out of ideas and just said soup again. Nothing was right. The answers ended up being address book, files, recipes, lists, and spices. Which spices, I beg to differ. There's no way the typical American has curry powder and garam masala in the front. They have salt, pepper, and garlic powder, and everything gets shoved in the back until they die. So now we were on the last round, which was fast money. They give you one last prompt with one answer, and if you guess it, you get the chance to actually win money. Name something that runs on gasoline besides a car. I buzz in with a strong bus, which was incorrect. I'm not wrong, though. I see you going to the comments. Google says a bus is a separate vehicle from trucks, cars, vans, lorries, etc. It is not any of them. That's what Google says. Lawnmower. All we proved was America is bogging down Family Feud with their stupid wrong answers. I don't want to win that dumb freedom money anyway. With $0 in our pocket, we moved on to The Price is Right. I've actually never watched this game show before, so I was learning as we went. Four lucky contestants from the audience are given a random item, and the closest one to guess the actual price of it, without going over, is selected to come up on stage and play more games to earn money. And I learned that even if I was one of the lucky four people selected,
I wouldn't even get the chance to be on the actual show. The game gave me 6 chances to be the closest one to the price of the items, and I lost every single one. But hypothetically, even if I miraculously was the winner and taken on stage, I still would have won nothing. I tried twice for content and still ended up with $0. So we're entering our last game show of the day, and we've got a whopping $0 to our name after being on 2 of the most popular shows created. We really need to make this one count, because I am going to look like such an idiot if I was on 3 game shows and came back with zero money. We walk out on stage. The spotlight finds us. Jeff Foxworthy raises the microphone to his mouth and welcomes us to Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? The show where you're given trivia children up to grade 5 are taught. Answer them all correctly and we could be leaving the show with $1 million in our pockets. But fail and you're doomed to know you're not smarter than a literal child who has to raise their hand to go to the bathroom. That's Jeff's favorite line to drop when people lose. He says it all the time, it's like his go-to roast. Every couple of questions you have to pick a child they have provided to help you out. You're given the chance to either peek at their answer or copy their answer, but you can only do those once. They're like your child lifelines. I picked Jeremy as our first little buddy. I liked his enthusiasm, and he gave us a really good high five. The subject we chose was under fourth grade math, and the question was, how many lines of symmetry are found on the following shape? It showed us a picture of a pentagon. I accidentally thought it was a hexagon at first, which was not my finest moment. And then it glitched and never went away. We couldn't get the pentagon to disappear and literally couldn't read the multiple choice answers. Our thoughts were, since we wanted to punch in the answer of 1, yes, I know, another not the finest moment. Look, I was stressed, okay? The pentagon was freaking me out. I wanted to say 1. Surely they would have put the answers in ascending order, A being the smallest number, and D being the highest. So we locked in A, hoping it was 1.
Lock in.
Oh, man.
Locking in.
So, no!
Let's restart.
First of all, 7 was completely the opposite of what we were trying to say. Second of all, we wouldn't have been right in the first place. And third of all, Jeremy ended up saving our hides. So besides being able to either peek at or copy your student's answer, if you ever get something wrong but the kid gets it right, you get to be saved and are still in the game. Like the rest of the lifelines, it can only be applied once, and Jeremy was here to be our pentagon-knowing hero. Anyway, we restarted. That attempt, we weren't counting that one because that was just a practice round, and the forever-lasting pentagon wasn't fair. It messed with our heads. But this one's for real now. Attempt 2 started and was going well. We ended up getting to the 6th question without any problems. But of course, as our luck would have it, we were given another glitch question where they gave us an image, and then we can't read the answers. This time the question was from 4th grade social studies. What is the shape of the following landmark? And then it showed us this. I didn't know what it was called, but Kelsey was sure it was the obelisk, and we could barely see that as answer C. Even though we were 99% sure we should just lock in C, I wanted to play it safe and copy our chosen student Alicia's answer. So we copied her, and Jeff Foxworthy revealed the correct answer, which was C, obelisk. Jordan, Kelsey, and I all celebrated because we were right, but in a very unfortunate turn of events, it was revealed that Alicia punched her answer in as B, pyramid. What, you little, oh my god. Attempt 3. We really wanted to do 1 attempt each with the game shows because on national TV you've only got 1 shot to make your money, but I don't think there's ever been times on Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader where Jeff Foxworthy tapes the obelisk to your face and makes you guess on while you're locking in. This time, I'll say it now, we didn't get any questions where the pictures perpetually blocked the answers. It was all a fair fight, and whatever we win on this try is what we're going with. And it was going well. Really well, in fact. 3rd grade animal science. Which of the following animals has 8 arms? Ha! Octopus. I knew that one. 3rd grade music. A symbol that represents the duration and pitch is also known as what? Musical note. Then we got stuck on 5th grade measurements. 9 meters is how many yards? I don't know that. I am an unfortunate slave to the imperial system. So we decided to copy Juliet's answer, which was 9.8. She was right. We got to move on, even passing the $25,000 benchmark question. That means if we end up flunking out from this point on, we still get to leave with 25K. Solid, but we're going for that million. By the way, I had no idea you could win that much money on this show. They could ask you, what's this? And then you say the color wheel, and then you can walk out with $300,000. That's absolutely bonkers. Anyway, we were getting far. Really far. 50,000, 100,000, 175,000, 300,000. We were still in it. The $500,000 question arrived. Fourth grade inventors. Which inventor's improvements to the steam engine were instrumental in starting the Industrial Revolution? We didn't know. None of the choices seemed right, as in, we didn't know who any of them were besides Benjamin Franklin, and I don't think he did that. After a lot of back and forth, we decided to guess on Robert Fulton, which was the wrong answer. We were out. But then we realized we still had hope. We hadn't been saved yet. If the student we chose during this round got it right, we can still keep going. Jordan, Kelsey, and I looked to our side to realize Alicia, the girl who thought this was a pyramid. We're doomed. We had no more child lifelines left. Where was Jeremy when we needed him? She reveals her answer. James Watt. She was right! We were saved! You were just saved by someone who needs to raise their hand to go to the bathroom. Jeff, we made it. We got to the $1 million question. Apparently, they tell you what the subject is gonna be, and if you don't want to take it, you can still walk away with $500,000, which is very generous. But the catch is, it's not multiple choice. You have to submit your answer yourself. Which, being real, if I was really on this show, I would just be like, all right, cool, see ya, and settle on the $500,000. Are you kidding me? That's $500,000. I've proven enough here. I'm going home now. But for the sake of the video, we went all in. The subject was earth science. And the question was, what do you call the process of heating water into steam and then cooling it to purify it? To which I was like, I don't know. But miraculously, Jordan knew it.
I might know this.
Fucking,
Oh my God, I don't know this.
That's distillation.
Is it?
Good job, babe.
Yeah, right?
How do you spell that?
D-I-S-T.
Isn't that what you do to alcohol?
Yeah, I-L-L. Distill. I'm pretty sure.
It's a better word than I would have said.
I would have said, Jeff, I don't know.
Locking in?
I hope so. I hope
that they're not right. Like, actually, it's distillation.
Here's the correct word. Condensation.
Now locked in for the final time.
Oh my God, fingers crossed.
Is on the line.
Everyone in the audience crossed their arms for getting at the same time.
They're pissed.
It's not easy. You will lose $475,000 and walk out of here.
$25,000 is still a juicy amount.
It's a good amount.
Like, I'd still be happy. Like, very happy.
Me too.
No, I'm sorry.
No?
What?
What is it?
I can't believe what a moron I am.
You're this not is a my moron. Bad.
Show us the what? Correct answer, please.
I swear to God.
We were right. No, 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 no. We won that million. I don't care what the game says. We won that $1 million fair and square. It's distillation, not distilling. Shut up, Jeff Foxworthy. Go back to making barbecue sauce. So let's see what we made. Family Feud? Nothing. Price is Right? Wouldn't have even made it on stage. Are you smarter than a fifth grader? Hypothetically, $1 million. I'm happy with that. Thanks for watching. I wanted to mention again, we're selling a really cool Jaden anime bundle that includes a new figure, vinyl record with Japanese and English versions of our Rise Above song, Ari cards, stickers. Go to JadenAnimations.com and follow our shop Twitter at JadenShop for updates and sneak peeks on what we're working on. Alright, thanks for letting me shill. Bye bye.
As someone who's been telling stories and experiences from my life for way too long, I feel like you've gotten the general gist of the type of person I am. There's very few things I haven't talked about that express new information about myself, but there's a chance you didn't know about this one. It's not that I'm embarrassed or ashamed or even keeping it secret. I've just felt like it can rub some people the wrong way, and I simply haven't really felt like opening that can of worms yet. But it is something I'm relatively passionate about and hope I can navigate the topic in a
casual way that's more talking about my thoughts on it, non-preachy style. I'm vegetarian. Based on that buildup, I'm sure some of you thought that was going to be much more abhorrent. But look, I'm just trying to establish the tone here. You can never be too careful. It's been almost 10 years since I've eaten meat, and I think the craziest part is that it wasn't really even on purpose. Back when I went to college for a single year, I was living on my own for the first time. To make a long and complicated story short, I didn't know how to feed myself, developed a really unhealthy relationship with food, and it ultimately became this whole thing. It happens to the best of us. But the best of us also know that it's not good for your well-being, and despite how scary and difficult it is, you need to make a change. After a lot of trying and failing to get back into a healthy mindset with eating, I decided to sit down at a computer and study nutrition to feel more confident in my choices with food and use knowledge to make it all a bit less intimidating. I spent a long time doing my own research, looking into all types of articles and studies on food when I stumbled onto veganism. Despite it being a bit more limited with what a lot of people are used to eating, for me, it sure was a hell of a lot better than what I was feeding myself at the time, which was almost nothing at all. So we take those little steps. I was interested and decided in that moment that I would attempt going vegan to simply see what happens. Yeah, I ended up changing the entire trajectory of my lifestyle with a single, "Aw, hell, why not?" I would say I did it kind of wrong at the beginning. Like, I would buy a prepackaged salad from the campus food court that had meat in it and pick it off, which I know just did heavy damage to vegans, vegetarians, and non-food wasters out there, and I'm sorry, I didn't know at the time. It's common for people transitioning from eating meat to not eating it to struggle because it feels like you're removing a huge part of how you normally structure your meals. But since I was eating next to nothing every single day, I really never had that problem. I was adding food into my repertoire instead of taking it away. So basically, the complete opposite situation, which worked out really well. Over time, I started trusting what I was eating again, being a lot more healthy with my relationship with food, and along the way learned about the other positive reasons to go meatless. I don't really want to be the one to get into the nitty-gritty of it all, but if you're curious, there's a lot of environmental benefit, and as everyone knows, it's kinder to the cute little animals. They do some messed up things to those poor baby chicks. But again, if you're curious, you can go down that rabbit hole yourself. Sorry, I'm not touching that one here. Even though I was doing well and not having a hard time eating within the lifestyle, it wasn't all sunshine and rainbows. There were still bad habits in my head, and unfortunately, there's a lot of people that use the community to spread their own unhealthy obsessive brainworms around food, which in my opinion can set a lot of people back in their progress and close people's minds to the concept entirely. Everyone knows eating clean and healthy is a good thing to do, no one's arguing that, but it's definitely not achievable for the majority of people 100% of the time with zero exceptions. I would encounter people in the community bashing others for the way they ate their meatless diet, which I believe is overall bad for the greater good of the cause. The way you eat your vegan or vegetarian diet is fine. There's no specific requirement for the healthiness. Eat your junk foods, processed meals, you're not gonna wither and die on the spot because you ate a little bit of something fun. As someone who's tried a lot of vegan foods, I can confidently say there's a lot out there that do not taste good. I'm sorry, people might not like hearing that one, but it's my truth. Might as well do what you want to enjoy it. You're not supposed to suffer. Put it this way, it's way more realistic to eat non-animal product foods that you actually like than force yourself to eat the gross, bland ones that are gonna make you hate everything and give it up entirely. In a similar vein, the vegan community used to be extremely confrontational and judgmental, which has tarnished the perception of the lifestyle for a lot of people. And I've always felt like that stuff has set back the movement way more than if they were more welcoming and understandable and not mean. There's a bit of irony in the idea of veganism is supposed to be positive and kind to all animals when they've been very cannibalistic to people around them. That's my hot take, I'm sorry. I just think in the past, the loud minority of the community has used really rude and obnoxious ways to try and guilt people into converting into this very beneficial and productive lifestyle. It's always rubbed me the wrong way, and because of all the stigma, I used to be very embarrassed to tell people I was vegan from fear of the assumption I was that kind of vegan. And justifiably so, because people have been rude to me for it. Early in my vegan journey, a group of my friends wanted to go to Hooters. Personally, not my first choice, but hey. Now, I was able to accommodate myself when it was just me eating, but going out to restaurants was a bit tricky. I checked the Hooters website to see if they had anything I could eat, and at the time, it said they had a veggie burger at certain locations. Awesome. Now I have to make a single phone call, which I hate. Hi, thank you for calling Hooters. How can I help you? Hi, I was wondering if you guys, had the veggie burger? No. Oh, thank you. Sorry. That was the first time I ever called to ask about a dietary restriction, and not gonna lie, I wanted to kill myself after it. I felt so bad asking at the time, but looking back, I don't know what that lady's problem was. I know you've had to deal with worse phone calls. It's not like I was calling about your Hooters. Yet here you are, getting mad at the veggie burger girl. Luckily though, 99% of people have been fine with it. And I do think the overall view on vegan and vegetarian diets have steadily been going up. When people learn I don't eat meat, I can tell they start mentally scoping out to see where I fall on the meatless personality spectrum. But then I say my favorite food is French fries, and the guard is dropped immediately. Another normal part of the vegan experience is the occasional accidents that slip through. One late night, I was too locked in, and by the time my body registered, I was starving and needed to eat that instant. I realized I didn't have any food in my house, and most of the restaurants nearby were closed. In a moment of desperation, I ordered the fastest option available, vegan burger from Denny's. But of course, DoorDash complications always strike when survival is at stake. So I watched helplessly as the delivery time got delayed by 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes. It got there an hour and a half late. The moment the bag touched my withering hands, I was ripping it open and scarfing that burger down like a dying vegan hyena. As the food was hitting my stomach and vision was coming back, I noticed they got my order wrong. I had just scarfed down 3/4 of a normal hamburger. The only way I can describe that feeling is a simple welp. And yes, my stomach was cramping all night. I learned a valuable lesson that day. Never lock in that hard. Once Jacob and I were in Texas sitting down at a Mexican restaurant, I was prepared to struggle with options because, you know, Texas. But saw they actually had veggie tacos on the menu. Wow. Maybe the world has progressed with providing meatless options more than I thought. Even Texas is... Alright, so turns out veggie tacos in Texas can translate to the only thing on the menu that has vegetables. I partially blame myself for that one. Texas was the one that tricked me, but I did have the context clues. Another time, I was at a karaoke party with a big group of friends, and there was a various assortment of food platters. The lights were low and flashing different colors, so it was hard to see which foods were what. A friend and I hovered over one of the platters, and I pointed to one section asking if it was fried pickles. They grabbed one, went, "Yeah, I think so," and popped it in their mouth. As a pickle lover, I was like, "Hell yeah," and also popped one into my mouth. And as soon as it hit my taste buds, I instantly registered it was a chicken nugget. The friend, knowing I don't eat meat, stood there like a deer in headlights, digesting the fact they failed to warn me their initial assumption was incorrect, led me astray, and kind of indirectly fed me chicken. Everyone in my life has been very understanding and chill with knowing I don't eat meat, but there's still strangers that look from the outside and assume the worst because of it. In James's 7-day vegan challenge solves all your problems video, he nominated me to do the challenge too, but at the very end, revealed the joke was, I'm already vegan. So to anyone who didn't catch that, welcome in on the joke almost a decade later. Anyway, that was the first time the internet learned I was vegan. So obviously there were gonna be some obnoxious reactions to it, even though I was the same person I was before they knew that fact. I still remember this one comment from what I assume was a child that said, I just learned Jaden is vegan and I've lost all respect for her. Literally, how does that fact even affect you, child? I wasn't even the one who said it. I cannot believe he got under my skin with that one. Not because it's mean. It just doesn't make any sense. Just so confidently stupid. This was like 9 years ago, so I assume he's an adult with more sensible worldviews now. But I still hope he's doing bad. Grudges aside, I kept being vegan for many, many years. The lifestyle was really easy when I was eating on my own. The hardest part was honestly how it affected my social life. Whenever I wanted to go to a restaurant, I'd have to check the website ahead of time to see if I could eat anything. My friends were always having to accommodate me. No one ever said they minded, but it still didn't feel great on my end, even being a little bit of a burden. You don't really realize how big food is in culture and socializing until your diet doesn't line up with the world around you. On the flip side, I never thought meeting someone that has the same food lifestyle as you could be such a huge bonding experience. Whenever I meet a fellow non-meat eater, I instantly feel more connected to them, just based on that. Such a warm feeling. Just two veggie eaters in this big, meaty world. Anyway, yeah, after so many years, I'd be lying if I didn't say being vegan started weighing a bit too heavy for me. I started feeling the friction and restraints more than I preferred. So after a lot of difficult mental back and forths, I begrudgingly decided to get a little bit flexible. I say begrudgingly because it felt like I was turning my back on the morals I was living by for 8 whole years, but I figured if I was slowly struggling more and more under the vegan lifestyle, it would ultimately be better to just modify it than grow to hate it and give up on the whole thing entirely. I decided to let some dairy and eggs back into my diet for the versatility of being able to have more options in restaurants, and the few times I might want the flexibility at home. It took some adjusting because, believe it or not, your body will not be used to the taste and texture of food you haven't eaten in a very extended amount of time. But it got easier and I instantly was so much happier with the heightened ceiling. Also, I very much expected to have turned lactose intolerant after not consuming dairy for so long. Super lucky to have gotten away with that one, no problem. Really counting my blessings there. A lot of people tell me that they wish they could be vegetarian or vegan, but they can't because they just like chicken too much, or burgers, or whatever specific single food they don't want to give up. And to that, I always say, you can just keep eating those things while avoiding the easier stuff. You really don't need to box yourself into the lifestyle all for the pure label. Any little changes make a bigger difference than you give it credit for. And if you can cut out even a single animal product in your life, that's huge. Or even just have it as a treat every once in a while. Again, I feel like the all or nothing mentality with going meatless is the main thing that makes people too intimidated to try, because being able to make little tweaks to your diet is so much more sustainable for long-time commitment than assuming you're suddenly gonna morph into a completely different person overnight. It's not like you have to decide what you're not gonna eat from a single point and never change it until you die. You can add things back in, or even go the other way and try cutting more things out if you feel good about the first adjustment. Some people even just go meatless for 1 day a week, or month, or year. I think if I were to humbly request you take anything from this video, it would be to try and be a bit more conscious about food. I don't want you to try and stop eating meat anymore if you don't want to. Maybe just try and be a bit more cognizant and appreciative of what it is and where it came from. I'll give you an example. Say you buy some chicken nuggets, change your mind, and decide you want to throw it away. It's kind of like you just paid to kill a chicken for no reason. It would go a long way to save it for later or give them to a friend. I don't want to say that in like an accusatory way, but that mentality has changed the way I look at food and my impact. Coming from me, it's okay to buy and eat meat. I just want people to value it more. I felt a lot of moral guilt when I started buying eggs again, but I've gone out of my way to make sure I always buy pasture-raised eggs that came from a farm that makes sure the chickens get to live normal and happy chicken lives. Cage-free or free-range don't really mean anything. It's the food industry lying about not being mean to chickens. So if you have a little bit more resources to transition to other kinder options like that, it's always very beneficial. They unfortunately tend to be more more expensive, though, so I know it's not a viable choice for everyone, which is understandable. I hope that doesn't come off as preachy. Oh god, who put this soapbox under my feet? I'm trying to find a middle ground of talking about this stuff in an open and non-pushy way while also making sure I can get my thoughts out there. There's just a lot of shady, evil practices in the food and meat industry, so I want to do my best to inform people who do care, because at the end of the day, you do vote with your money. I'm happy and comfortable being vegetarian, but writing this video made me realize maybe I'm finding it a bit hard to be outwardly proud of it. I'm proud of the choices I'm making and the small yet important impacts that come from the lifestyle. But on the other hand, I've seen and experienced enough harsh opinions from both meat and non-meat eaters to understand the whole idea of consuming less animal products still has a ways to go. I stand by the idea that I do think the stigma has been becoming more positive and people have chilled out on both sides over the past few years, but I hope the mentality of it all can continue to be pushed in a more healthy and overall productive direction, because at the end of the day, it really does benefit us, the planet, and animals very much. It might not seem like it when you reach for the dairyless milk or the Impossible meat in the grocery store, or even choose the vegetarian option in a restaurant every once in a while. But it really does.
Thank you for watching. I haven't been able to announce it in a video yet, but we released a new Pet Frenzy merch bundle. We've got a tostada beanie, tofu plush jacket similar to the Ari one, cute long sleeve shirt of all the creatures. I know it's summer, I'm sorry. A fun sticker set and new bandanas to put on the Ari, tofu, and tostada plushes. Or I guess whatever plush you would want it on. I hope you give it a look. I think it all came out super cute. And yeah, thank you again for watching. And this is bye-bye for now.
For people who have been around for a while, you might be seeing the title and thinking, Jaden, aren't you allergic to cats? And to that, I'd say, yes. Kind of. I'm actually not sure anymore. And for the people who know anything about me, you might see the title and think, Jaden, cats are literally the number one natural predator to birds. And to that, I also say, yes, that one's 100% proven fact. So let me back up a bit and explain how we got here, because all the cards in the world were stacked against the idea of me getting a cat. Growing up, I was irrefutably and absolutely allergic to cats. My best friend had like three of the things, and every time I would hang out or sleep over at her house, I would be a sneezy, watery-eyed, snotty mess. Can I have some water? Given the fact my brother was also allergic to cats, it was set that we were a dog family. My whole life I went around not giving cats a second thought. I never had anything actually against them, but since I was forced to stay 20 feet away from them or suffer the consequences, I just couldn't get to know them. Plus, as a kid, dogs were always more appealing. They're more likely to be bigger fans of playing and running around, be more approachable with their genetically bred unconditional love, and can overall be more forgiving. Cut to like two catless decades for me later, and I'm meeting Jacob for the first time at his place. As we're hanging out in his living room, his cat Frasier comes over and greets me. Frasier is extremely social and vain, so he's always expecting nothing less than a never-ending stream of attention from the people. Even though he's very cute and distinguished, I deployed my typical foolproof plan of don't touch the cat. Frasier realizes he's not getting any attention out of me and sits down nearby on the couch. But a bit later, Jacob's other cat ends up making an appearance. This one's Taylor. She's normally really shy and hides, but does really like women. Which I am. Taylor ended up crawling onto me and making herself really comfy in my womanly lap. Jacob, knowing I'm allergic, offered to take her away, but this was actually the first time a cat has ever done something like this to me. I've always been a bit of a cat magnet, if you want to call it that, because I act like they don't exist, which they interpret as me not pushing their boundaries and creating a comfortable environment for them to come up to me on their own terms, but never have I felt like a cat has chosen me like this before. I told Jacob I'm happy to let her stay comfortable on me, and I'll just reap the consequences of my sowing later on. This was my first extremely positive experience with the cat, and I honestly felt really happy and special and wanted to enjoy it. A few hours later, I'm saying my goodbyes, and during the drive back home, I realized I was completely fine. No sneezing, no itchy eyes, straight up nothing. I was so confused and curious. Thus, the start of my little cat experiment began. Every time I went over to Jacob's place, I would let the cats be as social as they wanted with me. If Taylor wanted to sit by me, I'd let her. If Frasier wanted attention, I would pet him. At one point, while we were watching a movie, Taylor literally decided to lay down on my neck, filling every one of my breaths with cat dander and hair. And you know what happened? No reaction! Not even a little drip of mucus! Somehow, sometime, I'd grown out of my cat allergy and never noticed. Apparently, every 7 years, people's allergies have the chance to change. Maybe being surrounded by my friends' cats all throughout my childhood could have helped my body get more familiar with them. Either way, I've now unlocked the skill to survive cats. Oh, guys, it was incredible. Now that I'd been freed from my shackles, I immediately started taking time to get to know cats more. Instantly, they felt so much more cute and cool and approachable and I was really starting to like them more, especially since every time I would hang out at Jacob's place, Taylor would walk over and be around me and purr and, oh, it was amazing to be loved by a cat. So I really like cats now. And after some time, I decided I wanted one too. Jacob and I decided to peruse a local cat rescue's website just to see what cats were available. I don't want to get one right away. There's a lot I have going on, but it doesn't hurt to, oh my god, that one. I want that one so bad. It's so cute. What's its name? Tostada. Tostada. Tostada, my beloved. We have to send in an application. We have to. Hi, my name's Jaden. I love this cat. Please let me adopt it. Please, 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 please. What? You guys know me. I'm weak-willed and impulsive. My first mistake was liking cats to begin with. The rescue reached out a few days later for a cat screening interview to make sure we would be a good fit to be cat parents. After being approved, they told us we could pick any cat we wanted that was in their care. Of course I asked about Tostada, but we were given the unfortunate news that she had already been adopted. No! We looked at the other cats available on their website, but unfortunately, none of them really stood out to me. The rescue ended up inviting us to a little Meet the Cats event they were hosting where we could see all the cats they had up for adoption in person, which was awesome because that was actually the first time I'd ever actually seen and held a kitten before. It was amazing. But as cute and tiny as they all were, there still wasn't one that called to me. I pried Jacob away from the kittens, headed home, and we started waiting. Every day I would check the rescue's cat list to see if any new ones caught my eye. I didn't even know what I was looking for, but waited for the universe to send me my perfect cat nonetheless. One morning I refreshed the page and saw one new kitten added. A tortie they found in some dumpster named Scrabble, with the biggest eyes and forehead I'd seen in my life. Something about this bizarre little creature called to me. I messaged the rescue about Scrabble and they told me she's available, putting me in touch with Scrabble's foster parents. Every day they sent me new little pictures of kitten Scrabble, and every photo I fell more and more in love with her. She seemed so silly and playful and those eyes. We got on a video call and they told me all about how big of a personality she has. Out of the 5 other kittens they were fostering, she was by far their favorite. The whole time we were talking, Scrabble was flipping around in their arms and looking at the camera with her giant orbs. I left that call knowing I found my cat. I needed to have little kitten Scrabble. Meeting her in person only cemented it. She was shy at first, but after flinging around her worm toy, she immediately started hopping around and being the life of the party. I talked a lot to her foster parents and they just gushed about how they wished they could keep her since they all loved her so much. Even though the rescue called her Scrabble, obviously that was more of a placeholder name, the foster parents called her Cammy, but neither of those really fit to me. However, I knew one name that I liked. Tostada. Yeah, I stole another kitten's name and pasted it on mine. So what? Big deal. Tostada is a great name. My Tostada is way more of a Tostada than the other Tostada anyway. Look at her. I would have left with little Tostada in my arms that moment if I could. But unfortunately, Jacob and I were going out of town for 3 million weeks and had to wait to take her home until after we came back. She was all I could think about the entire time. I was shoving Tostada photos in everyone's face every chance I got. The foster parents were for sending Tostada updates every day. I was overflowing with yearning for this cat. She was growing and learning about the world without me. Take me home to my child. Literally, the moment Jacob and I landed, we drove straight from the airport to the foster home to pick her up. I could not wait. We arrived home with plus one Tostada. I couldn't believe it. I have a mammal now. And sorry, other mammal owners, but it's the best mammal in the whole wide universe. Jacob and I spent the entire day playing with her, letting her get used to her new surroundings. She was so cute and so tiny. Here's a video of her eating wet food with a big old chomp. As someone who's owned birds for 7 years at that point, it felt so strange to have a pet that was significantly less fragile. And also draws significantly less blood. You mean this thing can't fly up and get hit by the ceiling fan? Insane! I've had Tostada for a while now. She's 2 years old at the time of me posting this. And let me tell you, this thing has become a creature. First of all, eyes... still giant. And she never blinks. Look at this. She was sitting on my desk looking like that long enough for me to notice, get my phone out of my pocket, pull up the camera app, put the camera in her face, and take a photo. And here's like four more. She is also not that smart. I'm sure you could deduce that by how she looks, but this thing has a single brain cell and it's just another version of herself up there with a joystick. Jacob and I are fully convinced she can only form a few thoughts a day and only in single word nouns. Evidently, Tostada is also very scared of everything. Always has been. Loud noises, quiet noises, no noises, movement of any kind. Even Jacob, a person she's been around all her little life post dumpster. There's been times where he'll be at his desk, moves his chair just a smidge, and she's darting out of the room. One time we were trying to explain to some friends how skittish she genuinely can be, and demonstrated it by grabbing a toy literally in front of her, raising it up a bit, lightly dropping it on the floor, still in front of her, and she bolted. You know how cats are genetically built to be good at balancing? Well, Tostada can't even do that. She trips and falls and misplaces her feet all the time. On multiple occasions, she has tried to walk across my L-shaped desk and just missed and fell down. That's like the one thing that makes a cat, and nope, doesn't hit the mark there either. She's gotten better, but as a kitten, Tostada couldn't even jump. After I built her first cat tower, I watched as she attempted to jump up to the second level, not quite make it, and had to slam her arms down on the thing to hoist herself up like she was mountain climbing. But oh, is she the sweetest little thing. When I got a cat, I was expecting it to want its own space, come around when it wants, you know, general cat things. But this creature follows me from room to room with those high beams of hers. She sits on my lap while I'm at my computer, lays on my giant Pokemon plushes, mostly just looks up at me from the floor and just stares. When I'm sleeping, she'll just crawl into bed and tuck herself up right next to me. Look at all these photos of her straight up on me when I'm sleeping. Don't look too close though, I don't have makeup on. Bedtime is sacred to her. She loves bedtime. If I'm working late, Tostada will come into my office around 9 or 10 p.m., aka past Tostada bedtime, and just start crying, scratching on my chair, rolling around on the floor. It's pitiful. And if I still don't move after that, she'll go into the bedroom and drag over her string toy she always plays with. It's just so sad and pathetic. I always play string with her when she brings it over though, don't worry. But lately, she's picked up another routine habit, which is pats. Not all cats like the pats, but Tostada lives off them. It's when you just slap a cat's butt and it looks like you're hurting them, but they actually love it. However, Tostada's really particular about pats. First of all, I'm the only one allowed to give her pats. Jacob has tried and she runs away scared and offended every single time. Second, she has to receive pats on a specific spot on the floor of the closet. If I try to give her pats in, like, my office, she bolts to her floor spot, staring at me to continue them over there. Also, she begs to be pat every single night. Like clockwork, she'll sit like a gargoyle in front of the closet and cry pitifully until I come over there. Now, when I finally come over for pats, she'll flop on the floor and start horizontally rock climbing her way across the floor with her claws and tangle herself up in the Ethernet cables while I keep up the pats? You think I'm joking, but I'm very much not. This is the only way she accepts pets, and I have to give them to her every night or else she's miserable. Tostada's world is so small. She's really just around me, Jacob, Taylor, and Frasier, but she loves her simple family so much. When Kitten Tostada first met Frasier, she was terrified of him. She'd been around other adult cats before, but she'd never seen a flat cat in her life, and she was mortified. Of course, she's since warmed up to him, and they play together and hang out all the time, they're best friends. But Tostada loves Taylor. Always has. She looks up to Taylor like a little baby sister admiring her cool, awesome older sibling. Unfortunately, Taylor hates it. They literally have a SpongeBob Squidward type of sibling relationship, and Tostada is so oblivious to it. Taylor has annoyingly swatted at Tostada so many times just for existing around her that Tostada now thinks it's a fun little game they play and will start chasing and swatting back at Taylor happily, not understanding cat social cues. Of course, never in a way that's too far, but just enough to get on Taylor's nerves even more. Between the three of them, they all have such different little personalities and relationships to each other. It's made our lives so much more entertaining. And to anyone concerned about the birds, don't worry. I've got Ari and Tofu very separated from the cats. They're safe in their own blocked-off room connected by a double door system that ensures no possible interaction between bird and cat. If anyone is thinking about getting cats and birds as pets, it is possible, but just make sure the two are very separate, especially if you have smaller birds like conures or budgies. I'm sure there's people out there that have trained their cats to be fine around a pet bird, but to me, all it takes is one accident or attack for you to just not have a bird anymore. Plus, having the two of them takes a huge amount of time and commitment. I've said it before and I'll say it forever, I love my birds to death, but they do not make good pets for the very large majority of people. In terms of allergies, I do think I was originally still a little bit allergic to Tostada, ironically. When I first got her, I was sneezy and sniffling. Nothing allergy pills couldn't fix, and it never was as bad as my original cat allergy. But I think I've been growing out of that one too, because nowadays I don't have any reaction to her at all. Bodies are a mystery. I am building my immunity to everything. Next up is rat poison. I didn't think I would make a video talking about this thing, but Tostada's just got such a funny little personality and has become such a big part of my life. She may be the description of autism, but I love her more than the world itself, and I know I'm the center of her little life too. I don't even see her as a cat. She's just a little creature that follows me around looking weird, but I love it, and I'm so glad I grew out of my cat allergy just so I can have her. It really has been so different owning a cat, mainly because I know Tostada won't just bite me at any given chance, unlike some avian creatures. Thanks for watching the video. Heads up, I'm going to be announcing new merch again soon, so be on the lookout for that. The last drop went so well, and I'm really glad that so many of you guys enjoyed it. I'm so excited to finally be getting back into making fun merch, and it really helps me out a lot. Alright, sorry, thanks. Anyway, I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye. Some of you may have heard, but a while back, Jacob and their team created a little something called Pokemon Too Many Types. It's just a normal game of Pokemon Emerald, but you might notice some things are just a little bit different. Everyone has talked about how chaotically fun this game is, and I finally found the time to play it myself. Let me tell you, everyone was right. This was the most insane, backwards, chaotic playthrough of Pokemon I've had in quite some time. Professor Birch is being mauled by a dog in the grass right outside my house for the millionth time, and after digging around in his stuff, I helped myself to a Popplio. But not just any Popplio, for you see, this one is silly. Obviously, I blast the Angiputiana to smithereens, and with that, have now earned the freedom to explore the world on my own. Yeah. Yep, it's dawning on me that I have no idea how anything works anymore. Trainers had all these new Pokemon, they're pulling out moves I've never seen before, types don't line up the way I'm familiar with. It genuinely felt like I was playing Pokemon for the very first time again. Weasel is water fluffy, Snom is ice bean, Machop is fighting stinky. Popplio, give that thing a shower, it reeks. Oh, that's super effective. I suppose that makes a lot of sense. Going into this game, I decided not to look at the type chart at all, which, by the way, looks like this. I'm gonna have to, unfortunately, use my brain and logic to figure out how to win every single battle until I'm the champion, which may be a bit trickier than you would even guess. For example, this Impidimp. He has now been turned into a dark gamer Uno reverse type. Naturally. I figured Gamer might work similarly to the Stinky type and be weak to water. That makes sense, right? Alright, well, look, I didn't make the game, alright guys? I'm just figuring out the riddles. However,
let's see what Gamer has to say against water type. Take a shower. What? It's got... What?
So here's the logic you gotta think about. Not only is it a gamer type, it is an Uno reverse gamer type.
Oh.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, as much as I might think I know how things would work, you're gonna witness that it doesn't always pan out the way it seems. I scooped myself up a Krabby, which, as you can see, is no longer water type, and entered the Rustboro Forest only to be challenged by a Team Aqua Grunt with a single Snorunt. I wasn't worried until I realized the hard way that despite its silliness, Popplio still doesn't like grass, and crabs don't mix well with ice. Wiping this early in a Pokemon game is genuinely so humbling, and I don't like it at all. Honestly, I didn't even want to tell you that it happened in the first place, but we run it back because this isn't a Nuzlocke, and my little pets are perfectly healthy after being dunked on. This time, we send the Grunt hightailing it back into the bushes. Despite feeling dumb and stupid and pathetic for wiping to a level 9 Team Aqua Grunt with one Pokemon, I waltzed into the first gym with my chest out like I earned being there. As most of you know, Roxanne is typically a rock-type trainer, but she's now studied the ways of the ancient-type Pokemon, which I didn't think would be much different until she completely steamrolled me.
Oh, shit. I got Doggy, but Doggy isn't gonna do too much here. God damn it. Waste of a turn. No! Well...
Her Lileep is crazy. Sus ancient grass type? How was I supposed to predict that one? What even is that? Now aware of the threat she had in her back pocket, I was able to navigate the rematch with Krabby the Fossil Killer, earning us our very first gym badge. Also, Geodude is boring ugly rock. I just wanted to share that one with the room. We took a nice boat ride over to Dewford, where we got to meet lots of new friends in the local cave, like Clink, the Prime Steel Guys, and Sableye, the Gamer, who has a little bit of an Easter egg attached to it.
Someone just pointed something out. Okay, will you trade?
Oh my god.
Will you move? Yep.
Oh, shit.
After saying hi and bye to Steven doing who knows what all alone with his cave rocks, we headed off to challenge Brawly. I opened the gym doors and was immediately hit with a wall of pure disgusting stench. Trying not to physically decay, we crawled through the gym's maze and were met by Stink Master Brawly and his smelly ass team. Krabby knocked his Mankey out cold, but Sock came out and started overwhelming my Pokemon one after the other.
Get so much knowledge. Oh my god.
Like, why wouldn't it be?
So you can imagine, I am not happy that this stupid thing is sweeping my team right now. Luckily, the Vulpix I caught earlier was able to tank its hits with its new fluffy type, and together with our own little stinker of a Stunky, we were able to finish the fight. I snatched that badge from Brawly's greasy hand and basically swam to Slateport myself to wash the fumes off my clothes. To dissociate that disgusting experience away, I went and caught myself a new friend. A ground friend, to be specific, as well as a little fluffy Stuffle. We also got to kick out Team Aqua, who was holding the poor Slateport Museum lady hostage with a gun. Thank God they were only armed with a harmless water gun horsey, because I do not want to know what dealing with an actual threatening gun-type Pokemon would even look like. Battling more trainers on the route up to Mauville got me back into the mood to take on the third gym, so I shoved Wally out of the way and headed up to Watson. Things started off normal, but quickly spiraled out of control because after Sableye beat up his Porygon, Watson immediately brought out his ace. You know, his famous star Pokemon, Whimsicott. And this thing just starts spamming its new move called Hype Train. Yep, Watson specializes in Prime-type Pokemon, which would definitely be a funny little hint-hint, nudge-nudge if I was streaming this on Twitch. But alas, here we are. Unfortunately, one cannot gift Prime subs to a YouTube channel. Sadly, all you can do is click the subscribe button. Isn't that just a shame? Well, whether you click the button or not, I got wrecked by this cotton ball. Hype Train works the same as Rollout, where each consecutive use gets stronger and stronger, and this Whimsicott must have had some sort of aimbot on, because it didn't miss a single one. It literally demolished my team the second it stepped onto the battlefield. I was also a bit unprepared and forgot to level everyone up, so let's just forget that fight even happened. Like, it wasn't even fair, so it doesn't count. Round 2 was where the real action was. This battle was much more neck and neck. Knowing what Watson's tactics were going into the fight, I was able to play around it much more easily. Jaden doesn't fall for the same charade more than one time. I'm like an AI learning machine, alright? I never lose the same fight don't look at that. With Watson defeated, I was now one step closer to becoming the strongest trainer in all of this topsy-turvy Hoenn. I caught myself a Honedge, Swablu, and Skarmory while scaling the mountain, and even had time to smack the Team Magma nerds around while heading to Lava Ridge. To avoid another embarrassing underleveled situation, I got everyone up to Flannery's level cap for a nice, clean, fair fight.
That's like, I think the thing that is hardest for me, reading comprehension. I think that's what I've decided. My god!
Oh, wow.
My crabs! Buddy! Holy shit!
Yeah.
What is the downside of this mystic fire? I'm just so weak to fire. And warm hugs. Do I have to wipe to every gym? Flannery.
She's mean.
I don't know what that Ninetales is eating, but that thing is not normal. After changing absolutely nothing about my strategy and just running back into the gym directly from the Pokemon Center, I demanded a rematch. Like, her team of fluffy Pokemon aren't that tough. I just wasn't ready to be paralyzed and incinerated the whole fight by her puppies and kitties and that roided up monster of a Ninetales. This time, Kingler and Sandslash were able to double team Flannery's fluffy team with much more ease, earning us the heat badge. With half the gyms now defeated, it was finally time to deal with some long overdue family matters. It's well known that our father Norman abandoned our home to be a gym leader in Petalburg, leaving me and Mom back at the house alone. Little Root has like 5 people living in it, and one of them's a huge nerd. That's like a social death sentence for a growing child, and I am filled with a burning desire for justice. After all this time, all those days of having nothing to do but watch Birch go into the same stupid patch of grass and get mauled by the same stupid dog over and over and over, I get to walk into Norman's gym and challenge him as an equal. Whatever reasoning he had to leave us is gonna be revealed in our battle. And it better be good. I walked through the doors. The air was weird and tense. Each trainer I battled looked at me like they already knew exactly who I was and shifted their glance away out of embarrassment? Shame? What is going on here? Not even the helpful gym guy had anything to say to me. He wouldn't even tell me the type theme of the gym. I burst through those final doors to find Norman looking out his windows at the horizon. He's been waiting for me.
Are you ready to fight Norman and his very fun and normal gym? Have you not picked up on it yet?
I haven't picked up on anything.
Say just keep going.
What is he gonna do? What Pokemon do he have? Floatzel? Okay. I don't get it. What is this riddle?
I'm just watching.
Glomp?
Is it because he's only using attacks that are cute and family-like?
No.
Lopunny. He can't be a fluffy trainer. That was what Flannery was. Puddle Slam. No. Fluffy furry. He said, is he a furry trainer?
Yes.
Norman.
Can't a man have hobbies? Norman.
Look, there's nothing wrong with being a furry. Many of my friends are furries, but to abandon your family to selfishly pursue your passion for Lucarios and Vaporeons and Lopunnies. Norman, how could you? You tore our family apart. And for what? Glomps and colon threes? Admittedly, his team was too strong for me. The bond he shared with those Pokemon was unlike anything I've seen yet. And I was gonna have to go back to the drawing board if I was ever gonna defeat a divorced man and his beloved furries. I switched around some of my Pokemon, headed back in, and again began the onslaught of devastating glomps and cuddle slams, weaving through paralyzing warm hugs and even the occasional cute charm. Eventually, it came down to our last Pokemon.
Okay. Slash.
Oh.
No! Shadow Sneak, please.
You have a chance here.
Please. Yes!
Now that my furry father has been vanquished, I was filled with an overwhelming energy and drive. It was like I unlocked a version of myself that was capable of defeating anyone and everything in front of me. I beat up all of Team Aqua that was infiltrating the Weather Institute, cleared Winona's song and dance gym without breaking a sweat. Maxi stole the blue orb to awaken Groudon like an idiot, so I had to teach him a lesson. Again.
You're gonna use the wrong orb, idiot. Why do you think the blue orb would be good for Groudon? He hates blue!
Team Aqua Rats did the exact same thing, so I had to do the exact same thing to them. I was on a roll. It felt like I was back in my element, finally familiar with the types, and was absolutely thriving. We pulled up to Tate and Liza's gym, ready to let nothing slow us down, except it looks like they specialize in a type I hadn't seen up until this point. Space. Well, time to slow down. Since I didn't have anything that could really handle space Pokemon, I went and caught myself a Bouffalon, because everyone knows Ohio type is good against space. I mean, come on. As well as prepared Sandslash and Stunky for the fight. I wasn't too confident, but made my way to the gym leader's room to find Clay. Where's Tate and Liza? Aren't you supposed to be in Unova? I wasn't anticipating this, but I guess I should just start expecting the unexpected from this game.
It's a double... Okay, it's still a double battle. 41. Oh, we lose. We definitely lose. Gun time. This isn't space. Wait, what the fuck is going on here? I don't know what's good against gun. How does song? Sure, we'll do that. Shoot! What the? He just shot my Goyle. He shot my guy again. That's so much damage for not very effective. We'll do that. Oh, he's dead. He's just so dead. Bare arms? Oh my god. What is this? Dude, this guy's fighting me with the Constitution.
So this isn't actually a space type gym like I was originally led to believe. This is, in fact, a gun gym, and I am being blasted to Kingdom Come by Mr. Red, White, and Blue over here. I failed to expect this level of unexpected, but how could I? We switched around my team again, this time for a high noon duel battle, headed back in, but honestly, it wasn't looking that great on attempt two of fighting a man with assault weapons.
And air cutter again. No! No! Take it, boys. Take it. Ah! Stop! How can you do this? There's nothing I can do about it. There's fucking nothing. This fight sucks balls. Mm.
whatever.
I genuinely think this clay fight was the most out of left field, chaotic, flabbergasting Pokemon battle I've gone through in my entire career as a Pokemon player. I don't think anything Pokemon could create would ever elicit the kind of shock and despair I felt fighting Clay, the Driftvale gym leader, in my Pokemon Emerald game.
Okay, I don't think this is enough. Yeah, I just... Oh, he went against Ori. That's so lucky. Oh? Is this it? Yes! Clay, you rootin' tootin' fucking asshole. I'm not talking to you. I'm not talking to you. Get me out of here.
I basically crawl out the gym with my badge like I just got out of a fight with Wile E. Coyote, because I basically did. And now I gotta go deal with whatever commotion Team Magma is creating in the space station. Withered and tired, I walk up the stairs to Maxi and Steven arguing about God knows what at this point. Girls, I'm gonna give it to you straight. I'm having a bit of a day. We all know we're just gonna hash this out in a battle, so let's just cut the chit-chat. Steven, get your ass over here. And after all of what I just went through, you guys are not going to believe what Steven put me through in that cursed space center. Yep, so the first fight, I went into it unprepared because I didn't know the team Maxi and Friend were packing. So that was a bit of an unfortunate disadvantage. It's alright, we run it back. But this is where things go drastically downhill.
Hyper voice. Steven, you're just leaving me in the trenches? Why even try at this point? Thunder? Oh my fucking god, Steven, you idiot. Why do they only go against me? Why do they only go against me?
Steven, you are the fucking Elite Four champion of Hoenn. Don't use Thunder on Aggron. It doesn't... It, in no world is it ever good. I swear to God, Steven. You're actually joking.
Steven, you're my guy. I've always had your back. I've been Team Steven since day one. But what in the world was that? This is not the playstyle of the region champion, buddy. Get up. Don't talk to me. I need some air. To blow off some much-needed steam, I infiltrated Team Aqua's hideout because Archie apparently didn't get the memo of my threat of a Knuckle Sandwich if he ever tried to use red on blue Kyogre. Knuckle Sandwich is delivered, but unfortunately, too late. Kyogre is already halfway across the Pacific Ocean to go drown Groudon. Can any of you adults do anything right? Hello? Earth to Archie's brain. It's hollow! I scaled the sky tower to wake up Rayquaza and rat on the siblings duking it out in the middle of Sootopolis. Off he flew, and after a bit of non-gentle parenting, the two slinked back in their rooms in shame. Yay! Land and sea across the globe are safe once again. If I catch your asses playing with these f***ing orbs again, I swear. Even though it was the eighth and final gym before taking on the Elite Four, Juan wasn't an issue. For some competitors, he could have been difficult because he actually ran a full-on crab team. Very intimidating. But I've also got a crab. And my crab is stronger than his crabs. So we won. After all I've gone through, this was the hardest I've had to claw my way to the Elite Four in a long time. But that just means victory is gonna taste oh so much sweeter. I entered Victory Road anticipating an easy dungeon clear, but from the shadows emerged Wally. I've beaten you before, I can beat you again. Holy mother! Okay, maybe that one was a bit of a fluke. I wasn't ready. This time, we'll... Turns out, Wally's tough. I didn't expect it, but he really is. This made me realize I'm not prepared for everything with my current roster of Pokemon, and if I'm gonna become the champion, I need to make some big changes. I've been swapping around my team pretty casually over the course of my adventure, but after locking in, I decided on this as my final roster. Primarina, Kingler, Aegislash, Beware, and two new members of Darmanitan, the Angie Fire Monkey, and Duraludon, the, you guessed it, gun. Look, I've seen the power of being able to pull up with a gun. I think I'm gonna need that in the fights that are ahead of me. With these changes, I was able to rematch Wally and take home the win this time. This is it. These guys are my team, and they're the ones I'm gonna become the best with. While doing some final training before the Elite Four, there was just a little tiny, unexpected hiccup along the way.
What was it? Oh my, Freddy, you would never. He would never.
I have to teach it to him.
I'll get rid of Earthquake for Bite of 87. Five Nights? What? What is... What the f-
Parish
song. Oh, Mike, Freddy, what am I turning into? You're not like this, Freddy.
For those of you who are unaware, Five Nights is basically an unhinged version of Parish Song, where after five turns, both Pokemon on the battlefield are hit by a 250 base power attack, and Bite of 87 is straight up a brand new one-hit KO move, where if you get bit, you die instantly. But there's only a 30% chance of it actually connecting. High risk, high reward type move. Equipped with a plethora of new threatening moves and mons, my team was now prepared for the final gauntlet. I flashed my badges to the guards and took a step into Sydney's domain. I like that look you're giving me. Let's have a good match. As someone once taught me, you gotta be prepared for the gun. Phoebe was up next with her gamer Pokemon, and even though I was able to take down her team with my loaded Duraludon and shower-giving Primarina, the highlight of the fight was when she brought out a Freddy Fazbear of her own.
Huge win. Beware. Oh, it's Freddy v. Freddy here. It's gotta be Freddy v. Freddy. And you know what Freddy does. Oh, he got the first one! He got it! That's my f***ing Freddy right there! Doesn't miss! He hits that frontal lobe every f***ing time.
I walked into Glacier's room. Larry! The third fight was against Larry, who normally is a gym leader and Elite Four member in Paldea, but looks like he also works for Hoenn. Jeez, man. Three full-time jobs? That cannot be legal. You gotta talk to HR. He led with a golem that only knew Stealth Rocks and Explosion, which is chaotically hilarious. But right after that, he sent out a wall of a slacking that took out my Duraludon, Primarina, and Aegislash. Finally, Kingler was able to knock it out after pulling off a few dragon dances. Sorry, crab raves. Since I basically had a crab bazooka on my hands, Kingler just swept him from there. After the Larry jump scare, I didn't even know what to expect for the final member. It could genuinely be anyone. Cynthia? Red? Clay Butt again?
What? No! You're joking! He's in the f***ing vent. No, wait, I'm facing the wrong way.
I didn't know that's what happened when you clicked the vent from that side. I'll be honest.
Not only was I flashed for simply going about my E4 challenge, but Elite Four Sussy Baka and his sus team went dummy mode on me.
I'm scared, so I shoot. Oh, no. Wait, this isn't good. This thing's gotta go. No, he's faster! He's dead. What? I thought... No! Where is he? Ooh, nice crit. No, they all vent! Stop venting.
Well, now I guess you get another crab rave.
I do. No! He avoided it! No, Krabby, I'm sorry! Ah!
I was not anticipating a battle where their whole strategy was to hide in vents scattered all over the room, and when they popped out, they hit like trucks. Not even my Five Nights attack could hit them in the vents, which meant I was just getting my own mons attacked by animatronics. Admittedly, we were vaporized. But shut up! There's nothing in the rules about trying again. It's not a Nuzlocke. I refused to call it there because I will not let my legacy end with... Hey, see that girl? She was on her way to become the next Hoenn champion. But she couldn't get past Elite Four member Sussy Baka. Poor thing. The second battle went much better because not only was I able to play around all the venting, but halfway through the fight, Kingler finally learned a better crab move. This whole time, I was being forced to use 50 base power vice grip, but now that we've got 100 base power crab hammer, it was lights out for these imposters. And with that, it was time. All that stood left in front of me was the champion, Wallace. Which makes sense because Steven was definitely fired after that maxi fight. Out came his first Pokemon, which was a simple Why Not. Now let me explain something here, because this thing is far more threatening than you could ever believe. This game has introduced so many new types into the world of Pokemon. Many of them are extremely powerful, but there's one type that reigns amongst them all, the absolute worst. And that's baby type. It's pretty self-explanatory which Pokemon fall under the baby category. Igglybuff, Cleffa, Budu, Bonsly. Literally the baby Pokemon. You know what this type is weak to? Literally like all of them. Think about it. If you hit a baby with anything, they're gonna be taking damage. It's a baby. So now you're probably thinking, okay, so why does the final boss of Hoenn lead with Why Not the baby type? It's also Uno reverse. That's right. Every single type effectiveness against this thing is now flipped. It's a defensive monster just waiting to counter and mirror coat your whole team to death for simply breathing on it too hard. I was genuinely so scared of this thing. I dragon tailed it out of there. That's a nightmare for another time. Zlatias got dragged out, which is crazy to say I was relieved to see compared to that masochist of a Why Not, but of course, it's still a Latias, so it takes out my Duraludon with a single Thunderbolt. Kingler comes out to finish it off, so next came Silvally, which I'll just let you watch how this one played out.
I don't think I'd get past this thing. What even is this type? Type Emerald?
He's a type type.
Type type. I don't even know what that is, but it's gotta be weak to Monkey.
So, type-type is more of a modifier than anything. It just doubles all type interactions.
Oh, shit. So okay, so your... I die here. What?
So, here's a little glitch. Sometimes, let's say the max damage you can deal is 999. If the game registers you as doing more, it overflows into 1 HP.
So, this is... Darmanitan died and came back to life, basically.
Pretty much, yeah.
Well, that gives us enough time to banana blitz again. Yeah!
We take those, alright? Nope, I don't want to hear it. We take those. The next chunk of the battle plays out pretty normally. Wallace did have some pretty scary Pokemon, including Steven's Metagross, he very likely lost custody of, until I was face-to-face with this stupid little bomb again. It tried everything it could to bait my Aegislash into attacking it, but we stayed patient. I knew I had a single shot at this, so Aegislash charged up as many sword stances as it could muster before slicing that thing to the moon. A final beast entered the ring. A true abomination called Sans Shedinja. This is the only Pokemon in the Dex with the Sands type, and it can only be touched by a very small selection of types. A tried and true nightmare. Unfortunately for you, Wallace, I've played the genocide route of Undertale. I know exactly what it's gonna take to bury this thing for good. And he's right here. It's a beautiful day, Sans Shedinja. But insects like you should be burning in hell! I did it. The strongest Pokemon trainer in this wacky world of Hoenn is me. It took so much more than I thought it would to be here. way more humiliating wipes than I'd like to admit. I lost a lot of battles. But shut up! You try playing it then! With the power of friendship, logic, determination, and maybe just a little bit of love, we've beaten Pokemon too many types.
And with that, we're pretty much wrapping up on 2024. This was a big Jaden year for many personal and content-related reasons, and I just wanted to say thank you guys, as always, for watching after all this time. I'm forever grateful for my team and friends who are always supporting me, and I'm looking forward to working even harder in 2025. I still can't believe I really just love making videos this much, even after 10 years. I hope that you'll continue to support me no matter what projects I'm working on next year, and I promise to do my absolute best. Until next time, bye-bye!
Back in April, Chikoa started teasing their newest project, Chikoa Park. Despite them not revealing any follow-up details at all, I was obviously frothing at the mouth. Over the next few months, information slowly started being unveiled, until finally, teaser photos. Oh my god. Chikoa is real. I had to figure out how to go. But to anyone who knows how Japan works, you'd understand this is a much more difficult mission to accomplish than suggested, because practically everything is executed through randomized lotteries. You can't just camp a website and refresh 5 times a second in hopes of being the first to buy all the tickets to resell, like the barbaric ways of the West. You apply alongside 100,000 million people, then pray on your hands and knees to the gacha overlords, knowing you ultimately have no power in this world whatsoever. I lit my manifestation candles and let the overlords choose my fate when I secured tickets. Chikoa, thank you for shining your light down on me. I figured since I'm gonna be flying all the way back to Japan for the park, I might as well spend my time as surrounded by Chikoa as I can. So I ended up turning it into the most jam-packed Chikoa-themed trip I possibly could. Sarah, good friend and fellow Chikoa enjoyer, and I hopped on a plane and sped off to Tokyo to experience possibly the most obsessive yet exciting time of our lives. After landing, sleeping, and waking up bright and early, I was practically buzzing with excitement, knowing today was the day I was going to witness the most anticipated Chikoa event the franchise has created yet. Equipped to live through the most memorable day of my life, we headed off to the park. As we were driving, my head was still buzzing with questions about what the event was even gonna be like. The promotion of the whole thing had been super secretive. I really didn't know what to expect going into it. The car pulled up, and we were greeted by giant Chikoa and friends wrapped around the building. This is how I knew it was gonna be huge. Please prepare yourself. We walked through a very hypnotizing Chikoa portal that opened up to the welcoming first room. You could sit in Raku's car, see Shisa and Ramen Yoroi-san chatting together, and even spot a cheeky little Momonga and Furuhonya. Also, naturally, there is a huge wall of Chikoa hats and headbands for purchase right out the gate, so you could walk around sporting your Chikoa Oshi. I will say they went all out on the character headband selection. Almost every single guy in the series was there, including the random enemies. As someone who tends to like super obscure side characters in series, it warmed my heart. Deeper into the room, you can find a real-life replica of Chikoa's actual home. Please don't disturb them too much, though. They're very busy studying for their reading exam. Good luck, Chikoa. I know you can do it this time, buddy. What was super cool was the specialized little photo booths they had. You and a friend, or if you're a lone wolf Chikoa enjoyer, that's cool too, sit down at one of the logs and are given the option to take a photo with either Chikoa, Hachiware, or Usagi. Whichever character you choose pops out to join your photo with their own personalized animation, which was such a wonderfully cute attention to detail. Sarah and I both freaked out when a shy little Chikoa shuffled its way over
forward to us. And everyone in the room watched as we took photo after photo after photo, squealing at every single one. Walking by, we encountered a helpless Hachiwate stuck in a ditch. Besides sitting there with him while he yelled for help, there was unfortunately nothing we could do for this poor fella as we stared at our own pitiful reflections above us. Knowing they recreated and built a part of the manga that made me cry gave me a very strange mixture of bittersweet feelings, but ultimately it was too cute to fully question the morality of it. To continue into the next section, you have to wander your way through the discombobulating mirror maze of the nightmare-inducing elephant. The lights were flashing various colors, the floor and walls were painted all sorts of disorienting patterns, everything was super wiggly, and I may or may not have crashed into a couple mirrors, who's to say. Sarah and I stumbled out of the very humbling maze eventually, but as staff came over and gave us Chikawa-themed 3D glasses, we realized we weren't safe yet, as there were multiple screens of various enemies hacking and slashing and call fat spitting in our direction. You really don't realize how many evil, treacherous creatures there are in the series until you sit in front of every single one as they try to get you. In fact, I'm realizing now a lot of the experiences Chikoa Park puts you through are the evil, messed up, life-threatening parts. True Chikoa fans know the series isn't all sunshine and rainbows like you'd expect looking at it from the outside, but that is the part about Chikoa that I love the most. Even in the most wholesome of lands where there can be giant rivers of miso soup, meadows of plants bearing toasted buns, and friendly neighbors that just want to buy cute pajamas, you can still get hit with 8 whole days being kidnapped, starved, and thrown in goblin jail for eating the wrong stupid-ass mushroom. Such is life. Don't stress too much though. As you can see, things find a way of working out as the giant cyclops Ode thrashes his way through the goblins at true scale. I really liked this section. After you all nearly escape being eaten by goblins, you're led into the shelter of a nearby temple. Chikoa and Hachiwate bear curious looks, innocently wondering what could await them ahead. And as you pull back the curtain of the next room, oh, it's the evil, dark, and twisted snake that curses everyone with eternal yearning for the mines, already amassing an endless hallway of brainwashed civilians. Which masochist on the design team pitched this one? Who was it? No, they even have crystallized Usagi. There's a tried and true hater amongst the Chikoa Park designers, and honestly, they deserve a raise. As you try to hurry your way out of the temple, Hachiwate is seen having to unsheathe his tiny claws in self-defense of a guard. Up ahead, Chikoa hides behind a mirror as the snake tries to zap them with his crystallizing gaze. It's implied the beam reflects off the mirror and kills the snake, but they don't specifically show it. Yeah, I suppose we should draw the line at actual death in the silly little Chikoa Park experience. Everyone is busted up and bruised, but finally free to leave the malevolent temple. What lies past these doors? Well, with the craziest luck, we happened to be there as Chikoa and Momonga were out that day to greet people. I almost crumpled to the floor right then and there in front of every single employee. Hi, Momonga. I'm a big fan. Don't listen to what the people are saying about you on the internet. They were so cute and energetic, and they even had Chikoa Park headbands of their own favorite or related characters. Any knowers. After many, many photos with our fave, I don't care if you hate him, you can pry Momonga away from my cold dead fingers. We were led upstairs to the second floor of the park, and as we ascended, my jaw was left behind. The entire second floor of Chikoa Park was completely dedicated to custom, exclusive, never before seen Chikoa merchandise. Which, yes, does imply the full story of the walkthrough experience on the first floor is you living peacefully in the world of Chikoa, getting trapped in an inconceivable nightmare maze, somehow escaping only to find yourself being jumped by every violent creature within a 10-mile radius, being thrown in goblin jail, breaking out and running away to a nearby temple, finding yourself surrounded by enslaved creatures controlled against their will to do grueling manual labor for eternity by an evil evil snake that crystallizes one of your best friends, watching poor, anxious Chikoa push to kill in order to release the curse, and everyone escaping within an inch of their lives. I literally could not have written it better myself. That is quite literally the best representation of the series you could possibly present. And as a treat for getting through all of it, you can now spend all of your money. To say it was overwhelming, it is an understatement. There were 5 whole organized areas for shopping and merch. The Chikoa section had big plushies, small plushies, keychain plushies, plushie slap bracelets. The characters came in any size, shape, or form you wanted, and it was very pleasing on the eyes, might I say. Hachiwate's area was more centered around decorative items and collectibles. Pens, necklaces, notebooks, tote bags, more keychains of quite literally every character in the series. Household items like plates, glasses, utensils, this really funny soap dispenser based on Chikoa getting a parasite. Over in Usagi's shop, they had apparel, lots of cute shirts, jackets, socks, and literally my favorite item of the entire store, the character backpacks. They're the perfect size, so freaking cute, and you can show off more of your plushies in the front pocket. Yes, I got the Momonga one. You'll have to kill me to silence my truth. Across the floor was a themed area for popcorn, cookies, various other snacks, but the part that stopped Sarah and I in our tracks was this custom keychain maker section. There were so many charm options. Letters, shapes, characters, references. Sarah and I spent like 15 minutes sitting on the floor together trying to figure out what we even wanted to make. There were too many possibilities. This was probably a lot to digest all at once. So to take a little breather, we can play the little carnival games around the corner. Meatball Korogashi is simple. Roll meatballs down the chute to try and get it in the skee ball hole. You get a trial roll, which Sarah and I both sunk, and then 3 real meatball rolls, which Sarah and I both utterly failed. In the other game, Kimono Shoe Catcher, you had to fling the butterfly-ified Chikawa, Hachiware, and Usagi into spider webs. Kinda messed up, but look, I'm here to win! I didn't get a single one in the net. I was just trying to keep them safe. Sarah actually got one in and won a giant Chikoa pillow. Questionable morality yet again being presented in this twisted establishment, but God, it's a good pillow. Chikoa Park is such a wonderful celebration of the franchise, and I'm so happy it's been successful enough to earn such a grand building and experience. There are so many little details crafted with love and dedication that any Chikoa fan would appreciate, and the inclusive of all the characters means there's something for fans of any creature. Yes, even that evil goddamn star that I want to splat with a fly swatter. Alright, well, that's, why are you... You're looking at me a little funny. I don't know what you want from... Okay, yes, we got a shit ton of merchandise. Everyone watched as Sarah and I frolicked around the merch floor, quite literally like Jaden in a Chikoa shop. It took like 15 minutes for the employees to ring up each of our halls. Everyone was happy for us and encouraged us to get things, but Sarah and I couldn't help but visibly succumb to the shame. With what broken Japanese I knew, I tried to make conversation with the clerk while we waited. Sumimasen. Chikoa daisuki. Hazukashi. If you're wanting to see the Chikoa Park Hall, you're getting a bit ahead of yourself because you might have forgotten we still have more Chikoa locations to go to. There's more. So much more to add to the final haul. Next up was the Chikoa Ramen Shop. The theming of everything was so fun. It was just like a little Japanese ramen spot with all the characters designed to look like they were employees. And even the glasses and bowls were specifically designed to match the atmosphere. Sarah ordered a Momonga soda, which looked like she enjoyed. And I couldn't help myself from ordering a Kurumanju beer. Yes, it was noon. Yes, I don't really like beer. And yes, I get drunk way too easily. But I simply could not pass up the opportunity to have a taste of Kurumanju's iconic favorite beverage. While I very carefully sipped on my breakfast, the staple and only food option of the restaurant arrived. The Chikoa Ramen. Since it has pork in it, I unfortunately chose to abstain. Sarah got to eat it though and said it was delicious, so I believe her on that one too.
Also, I think I'm drunk now. Luckily, the next stop was right across from us as we walked directly into the Chikoa Cafe. And thank the Lord, because I needed something other than alcohol in my stomach. Sarah and I were fawning over the menu because not only was there more variety, but everything was so cute. Momonga Furuhonya jelly beverage, Chikoa yogurt drink, Hachiwara and egg blanket plate, spicy Chikoa curry, Usagi flan, Momonga parfait, interactable Chikoa weeding tiramisu. Look at this menu, you guys! Humanity has peaked! We took turns tasting everything, and it was surprisingly all pretty good. Nothing was bland, none of the desserts were too sweet. I've seen some comments that the curry was a bit too spicy, but honestly, I respect the cafe's commitment to an actually higher than average spiciness, especially when it's colored bright red. By the way, the special cafe collectibles were so cute. Everyone had a little cafe uniform on, and oh. Since we'd finished up our meals, we hit up the Chikoa store in the Tokyo Station Character Street, as well as the Chikoa Land shop in Shinjuku, which were both simpler, but still very great for general shopping. We were very meticulous to go through and appreciate every section of every aisle, so even though they can be seen comparatively as just, you know, typical shops, you can imagine we spent lots of time there too. You know, despite us going to so many Chikoa locations, nothing ever felt repetitive. Even with the small little shops, Chikoa is somehow just so incredibly locked in on making great merch. I don't know how in the world they do it. Plus, they're constantly spitting out more and more. I thought getting into Miku was awful for my wallet, but I'm sorry, Chikoa. I didn't clock how much skin you had in the game. Alright, so the next place we were headed to was the one Sarah and I were the most excited for. Obviously, besides the park. The Chikoa Bakery. And it absolutely did not disappoint. The design of the shop was divine. From the colors to the decorative characters, all the way down to the actual baked goods. Oh, it was like nothing we'd seen before. And at this point, we had seen a lot of Chikoa, so you can imagine how much weight that statement has. The treats looked so beautiful inside the display, and there were a ton more options than I was expecting. Everything was, of course, really good. I really liked the matcha momonga croissant, but I thought the kurumanju red bean bun was the funniest little guy because it just looks exactly like him. I have consumed his beer, and now I have consumed him. Admittedly, Sarah and I absolutely lost a lot of control over the bakery's merch. Every few minutes, one of us would be like, no, I can't justify buying this thing even though I really like it. Buy it, you'll statistically never come back here ever again. You're right. This was the perfect day. I woke up, was surrounded by Chikoa for 12 hours straight, and then went to sleep. But I'm sure you want to see the damage. Alright, you've been patient. Witness the spoils of our Chikoa adventures through Chikoa Park, the ramen shop, cafe, bakery, Tokyo Station, and store. I admit it looks pretty extreme, but I have an explanation that's not mental illness. Since I've dragged so many of my friends into the Chikoa rabbit hole alongside me, I wanted to get them all gifts to, in a way, celebrate this experience with them. I was only able to bring Sarah along for this trip, but given the opportunity, there would have been so many more people by my side for it. Just that thought alone hit me a bit hard and made me feel really grateful. I grew up with, at the time, pretty niche and uncommon interests, and for the longest time didn't really know what it was like to actually be able to bond with people over shared fixations. Over time, I made friends that got me into their favorite franchises, but Chikoa felt like the first time I was able to get them into my favorite thing and have them genuinely enjoy it. Watching the people in my life take the time to actually get into the manga or anime, talk to me about their favorite characters, send me Chikoa art or memes they found and wanted to share, it felt really new, and I guess I just didn't realize how special it could be to me. So I wanted to spoil as many friends as I could, and given how insane the haul in the end was, it actually made me digest how many friends were impacted by my general excitement, and how many people I can share a mutual interest with now. Any character you saw in the pile that wasn't Chikoa and in some cases small manga, was meant for someone in my life that I got sucked into the franchise alongside me. A symbol of someone who I've spent hours talking to over this little thing, and someone that's made me feel really appreciated for simply taking the time to give my favorite thing a try for the first time. To break up the sappiness, I will mention that as soon as I finished setting up this giant wall of Chikoa merchandise to record that shot, Sarah brought her Japanese aunt and cousin over to our hotel room. So these two wonderful, normal ladies, who did not speak a lick of English, simply walked into Sarah's friend, frantically hunched over a giant hoard of probably the most obsessive and off-putting mound of greed they'd ever seen in their entire lives. Without being able to explain it all, Jugo Tomodachi. Chikoa Tomodachi. Hozukashi.
Since my last Chikoa video, I've seen more and more people finally get into the series as well, and it makes me so happy. It's a long way out, but I hope that one day America can have even a fraction of a Chikoa park that Japan has built, because it's awesome. Thank you for watching, happy end of the year, and long live Chikoa.
When Carl Jacobs popped up in my DMs asking if I wanted to be in Mr. Beast's upcoming video, I'll be honest, my gut reaction was fear. Mr. Beast has basically become YouTube's own mad scientist. He can snap his fingers and shape reality at this point. Despite part of me thinking I should just stay in the comfort of my own home, I felt really honored to be invited and kinda just wanted to show up, say hi, and then realistically go home within the first round of eliminations. I accepted the ominous invitation and before I knew it was flying to North Carolina being handed a custom uniform, all before even knowing what I actually just signed up for. I didn't even know if there was a prize for the winner at this point. Walking into the green room, I was expecting to not know anyone, but to my relief, I saw a lot of familiar faces. I even used this time to ask MatPat what it was like to meet Scott Cawthorn, and he told me FNAF secrets. So already, this trip was more than worth it. Eventually, we were herded down a long, mysterious hallway until we saw it. The Mr. Beast Cube. After everyone was filed inside, we were told the last person to leave the cube would be deemed the winner. And also win $1 million for their subscribers. This is for $1 million? The challenge began. Immediately, people started jumping in the giant pile of real money that was inside, throwing handfuls of bills in the air, laughing, mingling. To pass the time, James and I drew our cartoon characters out of dollar bills on the floor. The staff came in and ended up giving everyone their own personal vlog camera to document their POV of the challenge. And I think I genuinely was the only person who didn't record a single second of footage on that thing. I just thought, I'm not gonna use this footage because I'm not gonna make a video out of it, and they're gonna have plenty of other people's footage to use. In hindsight, maybe it would have been a good idea to record something, just in case. I don't know, maybe the Mr. Beast team would end up actually wanting to use some of my footage. Who's to say? After maybe an hour or two, Jimmy came out for the first bonus challenge. A single free throw. Miss and you're eliminated, but make it, and not only do you get to come back into the cube, you also win a Cybertruck for one of your subscribers. They had 50 people subscribe. Subscribers just in a room waiting for something to happen. I'll be honest, when Jimmy explained the extra credit challenge, I was like, hell no, I'm not going up to miss a free throw and leave immediately after nothing's happened yet. If my subscriber back there knew what was going on, they 100% would have understood they weren't getting called up for nothing. If I remember correctly, maybe 2 people ended up making their baskets and 3 people were eliminated. I could be wrong, I don't remember because I didn't vlog it. While chatting with friends, Ludwig walked up and asked if I wanted to do a dice bet. With nothing else to do, I agreed. And to no one's surprise, I lost. And an evil expression washed over Ludwig's face. Alright, since you lost, I want you to walk up to Kai Sanat and introduce yourself with, "Hi Kai, I'm Jaden. So which of my videos have you seen?" Maybe I should have just missed a free throw. "Hey Kai, there's someone I want you to meet." "Hey man, I'm Jaden. Nice to meet you. So, which of my videos have you seen?" "Excuse me? Holy shit, I'm gonna kill myself." "Oh, so which of my videos have you seen?" Oh, I'm sorry. I haven't seen any, I don't think.
Ha! That's okay. Nice meeting you. Bye.
Kai was super chill and nice about it, but oh my god, I wanted to rip my skin off. I'm stuck in this cube with him until further notice, and it's all Ludwig's fault with his stupid dice. I hate it in here. Let me out. Oh, hi, Jimmy.
We were told to gather up in groups of five, designating one as a team captain who will have immunity for the next challenge. I was with James, Schlatt, Ludwig, and Charlie Moist Critical, using the dice to choose the captain. This time, I actually rolled highest, but reassigned it to Ludwig because I couldn't cope with the idea of possibly being responsible for a teammate's elimination. And then it was revealed captains would just have to assign their teammates a shape for the Squid Game Honeycomb Challenge.
Okay, well, I definitely overthought that one. I had triangle, James got circle, Charlie was star, and Schlatt unfortunately got umbrella. The 10-minute timer began, and everyone started deploying various different strategies to get their cookie shape out. Charlie used a new technique called huck as much spit as you can into the tin to dissolve it all. It was really gross. He ended up filling the tin almost to the top with spit. By the end, two people with stars were eliminated, and not a single umbrella made it through. Bye, Schlatt. It was very funny seeing Mr. Beast lift the lid off Charlie's tin and immediately reel back in disgust, though. A total of 14 out of 50 people have now been eliminated, leaving 36 people. Honestly, that was good enough for me. Losing at any point going forward was already further than I was anticipating. We were fed our little thing of rations and left to wait again. It probably doesn't seem like long in Mr. Beast's video, but it was like 9 p.m. by the time we began the second real challenge. After being directed to choose a partner, James and I shook hands, ready to take on the next game as a team, and froze as it was revealed we had just chosen our own opponent. Another Squid Game tactic. I probably should have seen it coming, I just didn't expect the double up. The Beast staff revealed the next challenge as they rolled in a giant Jenga tower. Winner stays, loser walks. Unfortunately, the very first game of giant Jenga between KSI and AJ ended up taking literally 2 hours. Doing the math in our heads, we all kind of figured we probably didn't have the time to play Jenga for the next 30 hours. But just as AJ won, KSI hoisted him over his shoulders and ran out of the cube.
No!
Huge drama! Everyone was freaking out, AJ was stunned, no one knew what to do. Was that legal? Can you just carry people out of the cube? Jimmy had everyone take a vote, and pretty much everyone opted to bring AJ back in. Yes, out of the kindness of our hearts, but also out of fear of being manhandled. So since giant Jenga was a bust, production ended up scrambling to try and find like 12 sets of normal Jenga at midnight in North Carolina. A feat that seems impossible, but I feel like Jimmy could just call up the president of Jenga and have it all delivered via helicopter within 30 minutes. It took a bit, but the slightly larger than normal, yet still reasonably sized Jenga towers were all set up. As our game was going on, James and I ended up making a pact that whoever was eliminated would relay to the outside world that the other was okay, because we didn't have our phones, by the way. Our friends only knew we were in the Mr. Beast cube and haven't responded for 14 hours. Our game of Jenga was pretty intense. Eventually, it got to the point where as I was watching James pull out a final piece, I realized there wasn't any left for me to safely remove. I'm about to be eliminated. And a flash of bliss washed over me. Sure, I'll be gone, but that's okay. I'll be set free into the outside world again. The cube is harsh, unforgiving. It's taken so many of my friends from me. The glass floor is hurting my butt. I'm ready to go now. And deeper into the trenches I went. James being eliminated meant I was moving on to Cube Day 2. What a miracle. Watching the rest of the Jenga games was like watching an active war zone. People were focusing, cheering, sweating, praying. Towers were falling one after the other at the feet of now eliminated players. It was brutal. And also still taking way too damn long, man. Can I go to bed? The last game left to finish was between Quackity and a popular Brazilian creator, Enaldino. Apparently, when it was revealed the challenge was Jenga, Enaldino turned to Quackity and admitted he was a Jenga pro. Quackity had never played. Not the situation you want to be in. Quackity half-jokingly asked Enaldino if he wanted to play rock, paper, scissors instead, to which he replied, no. which, you know, fair. But 3 hours into this single game, the two of them were neck and neck. Genuinely the most cracked round of Jenga possibly ever. Everyone in the cube was gathered around watching Quackity slowly pulling out the very last piece in this skeleton of a Jenga tower. Just as he was about to make it, Enaldino asked, "Rock, paper, scissors?" Quackity looked up at him.
"Muito tarde."
It was over. Enaldino tried to hang in there, but in the end, he fell. 18 people were now eliminated. Alright, it's 3 a.m. Let's go to bed. I genuinely thought they would let us go back to our hotel rooms for the night, but... Man, now this is just great. I won myself a ticket to a night in the Mr. Beast Cube, sleeping next to a bunch of people I barely know, and I was probably just gonna get eliminated first thing in the morning anyway. As I was getting ready for bed, Kai walked by. "Hey, I gotta check out your videos sometime." "Oh, I'm sorry, man. I lost a bet to Ludwig and he made me say that." "Oh, shit." "Okay, damn. Oh, well, that makes falling asleep a bit easier. Thank God he only thought I had a huge ego for 19 hours straight. Crisis averted." In the morning, production had to prep for filming again, which meant they turned on every single light in the building, flashbanging all of us. They were turned off, and then these loud-ass brrrr sounds from construction started blasting. They turned the lights on again a few minutes later, but this time in a crazy strobe light effect for some reason. After breakfast rations, Jimmy returned, pointed to the entrance hallway, and in walks I Show Speed, with too much energy for a group of people that just had the weirdest sleep of their lives. Alright, you guys have the chance to vote Speed into the cube to join you in challenges. The kind thing to do was to let him in, but we all just survived trenches no one could even understand. We were trauma bonded together. And also, it wouldn't be fair. The majority of us moved to the voting side of no. Admittedly, me too. Mainly because I was a bit scared of him. Speed looked at Kai. "At least shake my hand, man. You're gonna pull me out." As the two of them argued about a friendly handshake, Ludwig stepped up. "I'll shake your hand, Speed." His hand now extended to Ludwig. The moment their hands touched, Speed started yanking Ludwig towards the outside world. We all started screaming and panicking. We couldn't lose one of our cute brothers like this. Ludwig was holding onto the support beam for dear life. Some of the guys managed to pull him back in, and as Speed walked out, unable to take any souls with him, he exclaimed, "This ain't the last time you're gonna see me, and I remember all y'all's faces." Alright, let's get started. Challenge 3 was Steal or No Steal. Basically a modified version of Deal or No Deal. Some cases have the word safe in them, others say eliminated. One person looks inside a selected case, and the other decides whether they want to steal it or no steal it. And also Howie Mandel was there.
Hi Howie, big fan.
People started getting eliminated one by one, others securing safety. Eventually, Ludwig was up at the podium asking if anyone wanted to volunteer to go up. At this point, the ratio of safe cases was very high. 60% in favor of safe. Figuring the odds would just get messier from there, I volunteered. Ludwig looked inside his chosen case, looked up, and told me it was safe. I knew mathematically I should steal the case, but I've been burned by math before. As I started hesitantly saying I was gonna steal, Mr. Beast suddenly burst out saying Ludwig's heart rate was spiking. By the way, he was wearing a heart rate monitor. Which made me scared it was actually an elimination case, and he was excited at the idea of avoiding going home. So last minute, I decided to let him keep the case. It was the safest play. If it said eliminated, then good, I dodged a bullet. If it was safe, then at least I'm not actually eliminated yet. I just have to play again. Shit. It was now my turn to bring someone up. Even though I didn't want to pick a friend out of fear of getting them eliminated, more than that, I didn't want to be up there with someone I didn't know. I picked Quackity. He came up to the podium. I grabbed case number 2. It says safe. My plan was to tell the truth, but in the most unconfident and nervous way possible. I was deploying every bit of body language knowledge I could think of, making myself look as guilty as possible as he asked me various questions. We went back and forth for a bit until... "Your eyes looked down as you said the case was safe, which indicates guilt. So I think you're lying." I'm not going to steal it. Without a word, I shifted the case onto its back, unlatched it. Safe. It was worth sleeping in the cube! Oh my god, the relief, you have no idea. After everything finished, a bunch of people walked out, and unfortunately, Quackity ended up being one of them. 10 people left. I know it's a dog-eat-dog world inside the cube, but when you're left to sit with your fellow contestants for hours on end between challenges, waiting for Jimmy Beast to send you all through another round of cube stress, you really start bonding with the survivors. It was pretty sad watching them go. Hours passed until the Jimmy death bell struck again, and we were told to partner up once more. Alex and I had really gotten to chat and hang out together as the only girls left at this point, so we paired up. Everyone was blindfolded and told to sit tight until they were ready, which is ominous. The two of us were strategizing and figuring out each other's strengths and weaknesses for whatever was coming our way, only to be unblindfolded and see the entire cube transformed into a kitchen. It was a cooking battle. We're actually What? Alex started panicking, saying she can't cook for her life. We were freaking out. Then Mr. Beast brought out the judges. Professional competitive eater Joey Chestnut, Miranda Cosgrove.
Hi, big fan.
And Speed. Bottom two teams are eliminated. Time starts now. We ended up committing to mac and cheese with a slice of chocolate cake. Under the fancier title of American Comfort Food. AKA, the only two women left in the challenge can't cook and they're trying their fucking best. The judges walked around to check in on everyone, and eventually Speed was at our station. So when you all were voting to let me in, which side were you on? Well, originally we were on the side of no, because we were a bit intimidated, but we ended up switching to a yes at the last minute. Right, Jaden?
Yeah, I switched.
Alright, cool. Because you know I don't forget, right?
Yep.
Later on during the challenge, Mac and Nolan from the Beast team came up to ask what we were making. At the time, I was grating up Beastables to sprinkle onto our cake for decoration, and I thought, oh, it would be funny to have them ask what we're making, and it's just their own brand of chocolate. So I was like, close your eyes and open your mouth, and gave Mac a piece of chocolate, and immediately without chewing, he was like, is this Beastables? And I was like, yeah. And he kind of stood there for a second with his mouth still open, and Nolan was like, oh, he's allergic. And they both had to leave. Oh my god, guys, I felt so bad. I apologized so much when he came back. Max said it was fine and is a good sport about it, but I still have so much guilt about being such an idiot. Ludwig and Amiksem presented first with their fried chicken and asparagus dish. The judges all really enjoyed it, giving them a total of 26 points, which is really unfortunate because I definitely thought Speed was gonna hold a bigger grudge against Ludwig and tank their score. We were up next, and thankfully they really liked our food too. Joey was the first to score us, and ended up giving us a 10 out of 10. And in the moment, as a joke, I wanted to turn around and flip off Ludwig as a, like, friendly fake gloat, but I accidentally turned around and flipped off Amiksem, and I felt so bad again. He was not the intended target, and now I was just being rude, and this challenge was going horribly. Not because of the cooking part, I've just been non-stop fumbling socially. We also got a total of 26, putting us at a tie with the French boys. But now, Logan Paul and Nick DiGiovanni were presenting. And I haven't mentioned it yet, but Nick is actually a goddamn chef. They even gave us all his own cookbooks as a helpful tip for the challenge, which is just a knife twist in my opinion. So yeah, they knocked it out of the park, got a 29, the judges were licking their plates. After them was Kai and AJ, who had a great presentation, but their food, not so much. They got a 16. After eating, Speed got up and started smashing the plates on the ground, and Logan Paul saw this and got really excited because he wanted to smash plates too. Without thinking, he ran out to join Speed, and we all shouted at him in panic. Confused at the sudden change in the air, Logan looked back at us before realizing he left the cube. To this day, none of us are truly sure if he did it for, like, the content or it was a genuine accident. In his defense, the set was so cosmetically different that it really did feel like we weren't in the cube anymore. Either way, he content creatored too close to the sun, and even though he had a guaranteed spot in the finals, he was eliminated. The last team of Rubius and Spriter went up with their Spanish tortilla, but turns out Spriter is a huge fan of Speed,
leave, so he made a special Thai dessert just for him that the other judges weren't allowed to eat, which is honestly hilarious. We all held our breath as the judges flipped through their scores. 22. Alex and I made it to the finals. I never in my life thought I was gonna be getting this far, and suddenly realized I need to actually think about what I would do if I won. I went into this thing not even knowing if there was a prize at all, and was now facing the reality that I could win the whole thing. Hours passed as the five of us sat together in the cube until Mr. Beast emerged for the final time. Someone was about to win $1 million for their subscribers, and it all came down to this last challenge. Honestly, among the group, there wasn't a single person I thought didn't deserve to win. Everyone left were good people who all wanted to do something really positive with the money. It was great getting to know them all over the course of 2 cube days, and I was really proud to be standing next to them in the finals. 5 briefcases were piled in the center, one for each finalist. We were to each take one, peek inside our chosen case, and within the next 10 minutes, discuss who to vote out. If you're voted out and your briefcase is empty, you're eliminated. But if you're voted out and your case has $1 million inside, you win instantly. It was basically like reverse Among Us. The first round started, we all grabbed a case, peeked inside. Holy shit, I grabbed the $1 million case round one. I started shaking. I didn't know what strategy to use. I didn't know how to make myself look like I should be voted out. And during the discussion time, it definitely showed because I was really quiet and nervous the whole time. The 10-minute discussion wrapped up. We all unanimously wrote our votes down, and it fell into a tie between voting out Ludwig and somehow me. It could end right here. We had a few minutes to discuss again and recast votes, but Alex and Nick were able to figure out I voted for myself, so Ludwig was eliminated. The cases were reshuffled, we each grabbed one. I pulled it again. In that moment, I froze. Since I was in the hot seat last round, I was probably gonna fly pretty under the radar this time. Someone else is gonna be voted out, and I statistically will not see this case ever again. If I'm not voted out here, I basically lose. The second round began, and it was pretty much a blur from there. I was trying to talk more because being quiet last round got me found out, but was still flying too under the radar. Amidst trying to keep up with the conversation, strategize, and hold myself together, I couldn't find my win con. But with a few minutes left, Amixem said something that I think shifted the entire game. What are the odds Jaden pulled the $1 million case twice? There it was. Gambler's Fallacy, save me. Save me, Gambler's Fallacy. I couldn't mess this up. I don't know what to say to that one. Everyone's attention was now on me, and I could tell they were all thinking about what was just thrown into the ring. We all looked down at our papers. I wrote my name as quietly as possible, worrying the sound of the letters were gonna out me. Jimmy read them all out. Jaden. Alex. Jaden. Jaden. They voted me out. I slowly walked to the middle of the podium with my briefcase. In that moment, I was the only one who knew what had just happened. Everyone leaned in as I unlatched the case and revealed the $1 million. I won! Confetti cannons blasted. Everyone immediately started congratulating me. All the eliminated contestants left in the green room ran out screaming and jumping around me in celebration. I started to tear up for some stupid emotional reason. So, yeah, I won $1 million to give away to my subscribers. That is a Looney Tunes amount of money. First of all, top five all agreed that whoever won the $1 million would give the other four 100K each to do something for their subscribers too. So a total of 400K will be going to Ludwig, Alex Botez, Amixem, and Nick DiGiovanni. With the remaining 600K, I decided to put it towards paying for as many people's art degrees as possible. It's really scary going into the art field right now, between the animation industry hitting their rough patches, AI threatening to take artist jobs. The overall career path is extremely intimidating and difficult to break into. I'd really like to encourage and make it easier for some of the up-and-coming artists by being able to send them through
through art school stress-free. I have no idea how to set it all up, but I'm currently working with as many qualified people as I have available to me to make it happen. As my and Mr. Beast's team figures it out, I'll keep you all updated through my Twitter. We'll get it sorted. I entered the Mr. Beast Cube ready to just talk to my friends and screw up in the first challenge, but instead I was isolated from the world for 48 hours, watched my peers fall one by one in front of me, and left with $1 million for my subscribers. Thank you, Carl, for inviting me. Thank you to all my friends who made the cube so much more enjoyable. Thank you, Mr. Beast, for creating this incredible opportunity I can now use to support artists. Despite being put through cube trenches, I had a really great time. And of course, huge thanks to the Beast crew for making it all happen. It was something I'll never forget or experience ever again. Hopefully.
If you're an artist currently enrolled in art school and are hoping to have some of your tuition paid for with the cube winnings, you can now apply through the form I'll have linked in the description and the comments of this video. The form will be available for a week starting the day this video is uploaded, so be sure to check the calendar and apply before it's closed. I assume there's going to be a huge amount of applications we have to go through, so expect a few months wait before we announce the winners. Thank you for your patience. I'm not sure how many people we can financially help out because everyone's tuition will be vastly different, but I'm looking forward to going through your portfolios and hearing your stories. Thanks for watching, and thank you to my team for dropping everything to work on this sudden video jump scare. Alright, until next time, bye-bye! At this point, you all know how I am about my special interests. My super addictive personality takes over, and I can get just a little passionate about things my brain becomes attached to. I just can't help myself. When I like something, I want to be completely surrounded by it at all times. Is that such a crime? No, it's not. I'm just enjoying life. You should try it sometime. My hyperfixations have always come in waves. None of them ever truly go away. They'll have their burst for a few months and then lay dormant in my head until something triggers them again. But guys, there's been a shift. The big one. It's finally happened. I've stumbled onto something that I have not been able to let go of. My brain has latched onto this new hyperfixation so tightly that even after several months, my obsession has only gotten stronger. It's this little guy called Chikoa. When Jacob and I were in Japan, August 2023, I saw these silly little figurines in a claw machine. They were funny and cute, so I got one and proceeded to carry it around in my pocket for the remainder of our Japan time. But as the trip went on, I continued to see this tiny white creature almost everywhere. Plushies and collectibles lined almost every store, posters, collabs, manga. Whatever this thing was, it was absolutely a big deal. And with every glance, something deep within me, some overwhelming force, urged me to buy as much as I could. I didn't know a single thing about this character, but it was addiction at first sight. This is a picture of the Chikoa haul I took back home to give you a visual of how much I descended into Chikoa madness after just 3 weeks of exposure. And as an update, this is my current Chikoa collection, a year and a half after my first encounter with the creature. The brainworms have fully taken over, and I am actively still desperate to obtain more. Coincidentally, a few months ago, the very first Chikoa pop-up shop came to America, and since it overlapped with my birthday, I made all my friends go to it and watch me buy everything. It was the best birthday ever. To anyone who isn't familiar, Chikoa comes from an online manga created by Nagano. The series hasn't really made its way to America yet, but it is huge in Japan. I'm desperately hoping this video will get more of the Western audience interested in Chikoa because I need it to be here. I cannot keep buying scalped merchandise through eBay. My bank account is melting. Please, Chikoa, I'm begging. But Jaden, this looks like any other of those cute Japanese character mascots. What makes Chikoa so special? Look, unenlightened viewer, just sit back and let me spoon feed you the incredible world of Chikoa. I will bear the cross of spreading the Chikoa propaganda. Heed my gospel, if only this one time. So, Chikoa, what is this thing? It looks pathetic and puntable.
And you are very right. Good job on that one.
The word Chikawa can be translated to something small and cute. And this is the introduction to the manga. I want to become something like this. Some kind of small and cute creature. If someone gets mad at me, I want to cry like this. And run away. When I get tired, I want to cry. And fall asleep. If something makes me happy, I want to dance like this. I want to become something like this. Some kind of small and cute creature. And then get something like a big cream puff. And bury myself in it while feasting. Then I want to cry because I got cream all over myself. And ran out of cream puffs. Gently clean myself. And then fall asleep while reminiscing. I want to become something like this. Some kind of small and cute creature. And then on a rainy day, or when I'm caring a lot, or when my legs are tired, I want to fall over and cry, and be picked up in a cart like this, and then get tossed inside my house. So right away, you kind of get who Chikawa is. It's tiny and pitiful in every way, with simple wants like good food and compliments. It's emotional and cries at the smallest inconveniences. I feel like at its core, Chikawa is a personification of the human desire to simply give in to the inner child's wants and emotional needs with no filter or judgment. It's extremely refreshing compared to the hustle and bustle of daily human life. After these first pages, the manga starts to take shape and becomes more like a traditional series with actual panels, new characters, and eventually there's even story arcs too. But sometimes a page is just about a character making good food, eating it, and enjoying it. And I love that. When I read Chikawa, it makes me feel like I'm timing out for a moment. I enter this world where life is simple and everything slows down. Each little moment and feeling gets to be highlighted. It helps remind me to savor the joys of the smallest experiences life has to offer. Even though some parts of Chikawa's world are unrealistic, like rice cookers found in bushes that always refill with rice, or a magical geyser that spits out fun candy, it's not a complete escape from reality because it still offers very real experiences. At one point, Chikawa sees that its friend Hachiware has a cool weapon to protect itself from dangerous creatures. Inspired, Chikawa goes out and gets a job where it pulls weeds for money. After some time and hard work, it gets to show Hachiware they now have a matching weapon of their own, celebrating and playing with them together. Not everything that happens in the world of Chikawa is good, though. Sometimes the characters work hard and fail anyway. Watching their tiny minds struggle to deal with defeat is such a whiplash because you definitely expect nothing bad to ever happen to them. I have to admit, the manga has made me cry on multiple occasions. No judging unless you've read it too. But when they do succeed, you really get to slow down and appreciate their effort to achieve things. It's so rewarding to watch them come out on top. You get to celebrate the characters' little achievements with them. I don't remember the last time I felt this happy even achieving something for myself. And here I am getting the warm fuzzies over a creature eating ramen with its best friend. I don't mean to make it seem deeper than it is, but Chikawa really makes me feel like I need to slow down and let myself feel more fulfilled by the smaller wins life has to offer. This manga is just so charming. Something about how Nagano draws these things makes me both extremely happy and also laugh really hard. This is one of my favorite pages in all of Chikawa. Hachiware and Chikawa are running with their container of sushi, excited to get home and eat it together, but Hachiware trips and falls, completely ruining the sushi inside. And the face Chikawa makes absolutely kills me. I use it to message my friends all the time. It's just such a specific portrayal of this tiny, pitiful creature's feelings. I cannot get over it. Hachiware then decides to mix the sushi together and they get to eat it as rice bowls. Happy ending. I'm trying to explain it, but you really just have to read it yourself. I love the art. I love the content. I love how I feel when I'm consuming it. I have to buy merch. Looking at them, you probably think all the characters are all just sweet little cute things and don't really have distinguished personalities, but you couldn't be more wrong. This one's actually an alcoholic. Let me show you my personal favorite, because, yeah, surprise, surprise, it's actually
Not Chikawa. This is Momonga. It's the complete opposite of what you would expect a character in this series to be like. It's selfish, needy, always telling everyone what to do. The complete opposite to Chikawa. Momonga should be absolutely insufferable, but at the same time, it also has this burning desire to act and be perceived in the most cute and likable way possible. It has no idea how social norms work. It is simply a conversational tornado, and I love it so much. I get the feeling I look really cute. Look! 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 Hey, you're bumping into them. The thing falls down. They made them cry. Will they apologize? Look, compliment me. They're terrible. Momonga might not be for everyone, but something about how unapologetically bratty it is lights up my world when I see it on the page. Like, look at this single panel. Creature lying on the floor, crying, someone is wondering if it's gonna apologize for pushing it down, and Momonga is just standing there, not giving a single shit. I wish I could be Momonga. As you saw in my collection, I have a handful of Momonga things too. I just like buying Chikawa stuff more. There is a Chikawa anime too, and I like it. It's great at bringing the world to life. I still recommend reading the manga first, so you get to really appreciate the personality and charm of the drawings. But if you would simply rather watch cartoons than read, then absolutely go for it. I totally get it. I just want you to consume it one way or another, so it becomes popular in the West and they bring the merch here so I can buy it all. What's funny is the anime episodes are very short. 1 minute of animation, followed by another minute of rolling credits. As I'm writing this script, there are 225 episodes of the Chikawa anime, so 225 minutes, or just under 4 hours of content. You could get caught up on the entire Chikawa anime faster than some YouTube video essays. Compared to what a lot of media is feeding us right now, where everyone is always trying to aggressively grab your attention, get you to click on things, make you feel angry, overwhelm you, Chikawa is the complete opposite. It makes you appreciate every small moment. You watch these characters go through their silly, imperfect lives, enjoying their food, working towards their dreams, feeling so accomplished and fulfilled over the tiniest things. Sometimes they get upset, but by the next page, they're already enjoying something else going on in their life. While you go through this series, you'll have your first thought of, man, I wish real life was like the world of Chikawa. But then you kinda realize, it just can be. You can take a moment to enjoy your food like they do. You can celebrate a milestone and feel just as rewarded as they do. They live in the moment, not stressing over what comes next or how they're gonna top it. And you can too! It makes emotions feel real and valuable again to me. All through these simple little puntable characters. Chikawa isn't gonna resonate with everyone like it has with me, and that's completely fine, even though they're wrong. But I do hope that I've convinced at least some of you to give it a try. You can watch the anime on HiDive with subtitles, but unfortunately, there's currently no official English translations of the manga. You have to get a bit crafty to read it at the moment. Until we get official translations, there is a fan-made guide to Chikawa resources in the description with fan-made translations. But be respectful and normal, please. To be honest, I'm a little scared of all the attention I'm putting on this community all at once, but please just be chill about it, okay? Also, please, you don't have to bring me up every time you see anything Chikawa related. I don't want to suddenly make this a Jaden Animations thing. Just enjoy Chikawa as Chikawa, please. Thank you. I really want to be gentle with it because I love and respect the franchise a lot, but I also want to share this series with you guys as well. Hopefully, you'll be just as obsessed as I am, and then we can all buy merch once Chikawa comes to the West, eh? Thanks for letting me ramble about my favorite thing. I love Chikawa. I hope you'll give it a try. And if anyone out there watching can tell the Chikawa company to send the merch to America, please, please. I promise I will buy it all. Please.
There's actually a chance I might have been pronouncing Chikawa wrong this whole video. I've heard other people pronounce it Chikawa or
Chikawa. I really am not sure, so this is pretty embarrassing. Also, while prepping for this video, I sat on call with practically everyone on my team, and we all watched the whole Chikawa anime series together for research purposes. And then they all made Chikasonas. I cannot believe this is my job. 9 years ago, James and I talked about what it was like living in our home state, Arizona. I honestly don't remember most of what we said in that video. I tried to rewatch it as a refresher and maybe a little trip down memory lane, but turns out after 5 seconds, I'd rather be guillotined. No, eyes on me. You clicked on this video, you're staying on this video. No funny ideas, all right? The other day, I was in a store trying to buy a plain black shirt that was locked up behind those stupid box lockers, so I had to ring an employee for a single shirt. A few minutes later, someone came by. All right, what can I... Oh my gosh, are you Jaden Animations? Yeah. No way, I love your videos. Can I get a photo? Yeah. Thanks so much. I didn't expect to see you here. Are you visiting? Oh, no, I live here. You're not in Arizona anymore? And that's when it dawned on me, there is a giant portion of my audience who will not get updated on some parts of my life if I don't explicitly say it in one of my animations. Also, the guy left without unlocking the box, so I had to wait another 5 minutes for him to come back and get the shirt. So yeah, to anyone who didn't get the memo, I've been in California for the past 6.5 years, specifically Los Angeles. I honestly can't believe it's been that long already, because that means for the past 6.5 years, I've been doing nothing but complaining about it the entire time. I believe in the compliment sandwich system, though. Not everything about moving to California has been bad. For example, the weather is great. It's always sunny, which, you know, Arizona is too. But, like, in a bad way. California doesn't hit the casual 118 everything outside melts and dies degrees like back home. It's vacation weather all the time. I like that part. The drivers here are f***ing assholes! Arizona isn't all sunshine and rainbows in the driving department either. When I was learning to drive as a teenager, my mom told me to never honk at people no matter what because there's a chance they'll just shoot me. But because of the sheer volume of people on California roads all the time, it is a completely different beast. And every single one of them is driving to go kick babies because they hate their fellow man. Compassion does not exist on the California freeway. And by that, I mean blinkers. You know, the very helpful and necessary communication tool that tells people you'd kindly like to move into the lane. It's a sign of weakness here. If you even think about turning your blinker on, every single car in your vicinity will speed up and refuse to let you merge because they cannot handle the idea of a different car being in front of them. How can they get to their destination faster if a car that was in front of them in a different lane suddenly shifts to the side 12 feet? People will go out of their way to merge into the lane just to speed past you and spit on your windshield. When I turn my blinker on, which I still do because I refuse to let this barbaric driving culture corrupt me, a car will speed up and then merge in front of me. If you need to be in my lane and I need to be in yours, we literally have to stay at our same speeds and shift. It's simple. There's no point in you blocking my merge just to merge into my lane anyway. Oh my god, it pisses me off so much. They do it all the time. If I had no money and got a dollar every single time someone took advantage of my blinker, I'd have enough money to move out of this godforsaken state. One time I turned my blinker on, checked my blind spot, and in the amount of time it took for me to look back at the road and start merging, a car way behind me had sped up so fast that my car's auto detection had to cut my merge off so I wouldn't hit them. And then that car honked at me! I will kill us both. Alright, the drivers suck, but at least I'm only going a few miles. Not only am I forced to drive alongside these bozos, I'm forced to drive alongside them
for way longer than I should need to. The traffic is so genuinely bad, I daydream of becoming a better sprinter to arrive at places quicker, because it is genuinely not far from the realm of realism. Either that or get one of those monster snowplow attachments. I mean, seriously, 10 miles? I should not be in the car longer than 20 minutes. Everyone here loves driving 30 over the speed limit anyway. I don't even know what the holdup is. Also, a little tip. If you wanted to find a place to park when you get to your destination, you shouldn't even be driving in the first place. Parking doesn't exist here. It's a myth and a lie. 95% of all locations have zero parking lots. There's never street parking. And if you happen to be a lucky enough soul to find a spot, you can't slow down to parallel park into it because people are either gonna yell at you for clogging the lane or ram into your bumper. It's just an evil trick. So your only choice is to find a parking garage that costs like $20. One time, my friends and I drove to a One Piece live symphony at the Dolby Theater and decided to park in its parking garage. Oh, what an obvious mistake. Do you want to know how long it took us to get out of that garage after the show when everyone was leaving? 2.5 hours! We parked in the designated parking garage for a show and paid 2.5 hours of our life on top of real life money. So what if you don't have a car? Then you don't have to deal with any of this, right? Well, you can't walk anywhere. What do you think this is? Any other country? You could get a bike or a motorcycle, but again, with the quality of drivers around, you might as well play Russian roulette every time the wheels touch asphalt. Maybe with the right setup and some expendable funds, you could just get around with rideshare apps. But man, getting an Uber is so expensive out here. It might as well be considered a luxury in itself. If you're taking an Uber either to or from the LAX airport, I guarantee it'll cost at least $100. And the drivers don't get, like, any of that, by the way. Once I had a driver complain to me about the ride rates the whole trip, which was not asked for to begin with. He said he had a client once trying to go to LAX, and they were being charged $100, like I said. But the driver was only gonna get $30 from the trip. So he offered to charge $80 cash for them to do it outside the app as a win-win. Don't ever take this type of offer, kids. That was incredibly dangerous. But that's just where the landscape of Uber is here. Also, fun little tip. Never tell any drivers the place you're going to or from is your actual home. This is for everywhere, not just California. Sure, if they ask, it's normally small talk. But when it's not, you're in danger! Yikes! Now that guy won't leave your driveway! And the police say they can't do anything because he hasn't actually committed a crime yet! Just lie and say it's a friend's place or something. It's not worth the gamble, and lying to strangers is fun! That was a free survival hint from your friendly neighborhood YouTuber. Put that one in the back of your pockets. Speaking of LAX, because I brought it up earlier, that place is actual hell on earth! If someone gets sent there after death, I would consider it a viable punishment for being a bad person. But innocent people are forced to be subjected to it every single day, and it's inhumane. You have every single asshole with a plane ticket in the entire city and beyond enter through the same stupid entrance, forced to drive through the same loop bumper to bumper until they get to their specific gate. No branching paths, no attempts to categorize the types of arrivals, just a single slaughterhouse line like cattle. But in normal slaughterhouse lines, the cattle don't hate each other. I was talking about bad merging before. It is legitimately survival of the fittest in the LAX horseshoe. Absolutely no one will let you merge lanes ever unless you threaten to fist fight them right there on the concrete. One time I sat with my blinker on in traffic that was not moving for 15 minutes straight, and a dude still refused to let me start merging once cars started inching forward. I had to sit there making direct eye contact with him until he was uncomfortable enough to let me get in front of him. It is personal. I am not the same person when I'm in the LAX horseshoe. None of us are. Some dudes in the 1960s decided they wanted everyone that ever planned to visit LA to suffer instantly when they got here. And they simply got away with it. I've spent so much time talking about traffic and the airport, I haven't even talked about living in LA yet. Well, that part sucks too!
Everything is so absurdly expensive here, it's almost comedic. Almost. Maybe raise the prices of food like 10 more dollars and I'll start to chuckle. Now a burrito's like $40. I haven't even had food out here that's blown my mind. Sure, it's not bad, but when eating out can get this expensive, I expect something more to write home about. There are some really fancy restaurants around, but I shouldn't have to spend even more money to eat a meal that makes me go, wow, I will remember this. It's become a common pastime for some people to pull up Zillow and look at all the really crazy expensive multi-million dollar mansions, fantasizing about what they would do if they were to live in the craziest of homes. But the equivalent of that for me and my friends here is to look at normal homes that are just not in California. Oh, look at that one! 3-bed, 2-bath for like $2,500 a month. That's insane. Here, the same thing can go upwards of $7,000. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm very lucky and fortunate enough to not have to worry about finances as much. I can afford to live in a more expensive place here. It's not gonna break my bank. But at the same time, I'd like to still be relatively smart with money. Sure, I tend to splurge on plushies and trinkets. Haha, Jane's buying another Miku figure. But outside of that stuff, I'm really not spending money on anything else. I'm not into luxury cars or clothes or any of that type of culture. It's trinkets, plushies, and admittedly, a little too much DoorDash. But I have a job that I can perform literally anywhere in the entire world. And I'm sitting here wasting extra costs on living in one of the most expensive cities in America. It feels bad. And I don't know if you picked up on it yet, but I don't even really like it here all that much. So, why? Why do I choose to burn extra money just to exist in LA? The single reason is, all of my friends are here, and I'd happily shovel extra funds into a giant furnace to be near them, because that's what makes a place feel like a true home. But all of my friends are also content creators that can work anywhere too, and if we all just banded together and decided to move somewhere else, that would sure be swell. Unfortunately, it takes a lot of time, coordination, and resources to try and figure out an entirely new place to move a giant friend group of people, so we've essentially soft-locked ourselves here until we can all agree it's time to get out of here. I'll give LA some credit. The main thing that makes it great is the fact that everything is always happening here. There is always some sort of fun event going on. Concerts, tours, random pop-ups. I went to a live screening of the season 2 finale of Severance where the cast got to talk about it afterwards, and that was one of the coolest experiences of my life so far. You name it, it is happening in California. Truly, you will never be bored here if you're always looking for something to do, and I recognize that is incredibly valuable. But at the same time, it means there's always tourists visiting, and Los Angeles is a very disgusting city for tourists to visit. It smells like pee all the time. The tourist trap areas are so trashy, there's constant crowds everywhere you go. When it rains, the pee smells even worse. Every once in a while, I need to go into the city for some reason or another, and those are bad days. Also, if you want to see all these cool things, you don't have to live in California to begin with. In fact, living here only desensitizes me to all the awesome stuff constantly around. Back when I first moved, I was really close to Disneyland, and for the entire 2 years I spent over there, I only went to the alleged happiest place on Earth a single time because of a friend's birthday. That's more of a personal experience, though. I know plenty of people who have yearly passes to Disney or Universal who go to them all the time. But for me, I always just think, I can go there anytime, so maybe later. And then later is multiple years. I consider it a privilege to be able to live in LA. It's expensive, a lot of people dream of coming here and making it big, and if you can afford it, you can definitely live luxuriously. But I am just really not built for all that. I grew up in a tiny desert town with like no people in it, and prefer to be holed up in my house 90% of the time watching YouTube until my brain is mush.
However, as much as I want to uproot everything again to live somewhere else less expensive and more compatible with my preferred lifestyle, I do think LA is a good place for me to be right now. Both the YouTube and animation industry are here. I don't need to travel for most of the events I get invited to. And content creators are always visiting for something or another, so I get to meet a lot of fellow creator friends. I can't say anywhere else in the world can offer all these benefits that specifically apply to me right now, and it's also just a lot of fun. I might not exactly like it, but LA is my home for at least the next few years, and I do get to have a lot of fun here with my friends. It's a toxic relationship, I suppose, but I'm sure in a decade when I'm somewhere else and reminiscing on the past, I'll have very fond memories of it all. So I can complain all I want while I'm here, but deep down, I know California has been such a huge part of the most defining years of my life, and I'll hold a very special place for it in my heart for a long time. LAX and the drivers are just excluded from it, though. I'll hate those parts forever.
I posted a little video, but if you missed it, we're selling Tostada merch for the first time ever because everyone begged and pleaded for it. Please go check it all out. I think everything turned out so silly and good, and she's only available until September 7th. And here's a picture of her for the people who stayed till the end of the video. Okay, bye-bye!
One time I was at an arcade and saw someone with an Ari bag, so I went up to them and said, "Hey, I really like your bag." She turned around, looked straight at me, and said, "Thanks, it's from Jaden Animations." "Oh, cool." And then I just walked away because I didn't know how to salvage that interaction without being weird about it. As someone who has somehow amassed big number on YouTube website, you'd probably expect me to be recognized fairly frequently when I'm out on the town. I do definitely get recognized here and there, but given that almost all of the content I've posted is me in cartoon form, it's much less than you'd think. I don't really expect to be recognized unless I'm going somewhere that attracts people who are more online, such as conventions or Hatsune Miku concerts. Of course, I've been in plenty of IRL content on other people's channels, so it's not like no one knows what I look like, but that barrier has given a bit of cushion on how often people will notice that Jaden Animations is in their vicinity. The majority of my fan interactions are very positive and follow this general flow. "Are you Jaden Animations?" "Yeah." "Oh, that's so cool. I love your videos. Can I get a photo?" "Yeah." "Alright, thanks, bye." It's simple, it's streamlined, everyone's happy. Of course, not every interaction goes like this, and naturally, people always want to know about the outliers, the bad interactions, the weird ones. Any freaks out there that you've met, Jaden? I'm lucky enough to be able to say, you guys are pretty normal. There's not really any single experience that comes to mind when people ask me that. So thank you. Gold star to every single person I've met in my entire career so far. However, I do have some funny stories I've collected. Like one time, Jacob and I were sitting down at the Toadstool Cafe to film for their video about Nintendo Land when this one guy walked by and recognized Jacob. "Oh my gosh, are you Alpha Red?" "Yeah." "Oh, that's so cool. I love your videos. Can I get a photo?" "Yeah." You know, everything's going as per the script. At this point, I piped up and asked, "Would you like me to take the photo for you?" And as I said that, Jacob and I both saw that the guy suddenly recognized my voice, and therefore, me. Now knowing there were two YouTubers at that table, he started to ask if I was Jaden, but mid-sentence realized that if he was incorrect, it would look a little tiny bit racist. You know, you can't always just assume the Asian girl with Alpha Red is Jaden, even though 90% of the time you'd be correct. So he ended up pivoting halfway through to cover for the mistake, which ended up like this. "Would you like me to take the photo for you?" "Oh, correct me if I'm wrong, but who are you?" Of course, we knew what he meant. I say I'm Jaden, everything is fine, we all take a photo together. But being able to see the line his brain took in real time was so funny. It's one of my and Jacob's favorite stories because he meant so well. Like, I completely understand what happened. But also asking, "Sorry, but who are you?" to someone offering to take a photo is just I would love to meet that guy again and just tell him how much we loved that interaction. Dude, if you're out there, I hope your Toadstool Cafe food was good. Because ours wasn't. There actually have been times, though, where people have thought they've run into me and were just wrong. I've seen tweets tagging me like, OMG, just met Jaden Animations! As I'm currently sitting at home looking at a photo of some poor random Asian girl. When we were all on tour for a Scribble Showdown a while back in Chicago, James and Emily went to go look at the bean, and James ended up getting recognized. While he was talking to the group of people, one of them saw Emily and went, "Oh my gosh! It's Jaden!" James immediately starts laughing his ass off trying to correct them, but somehow wasn't clear enough because when they were all taking a photo, they were like, "Jaden, get in front!" Another time, when Jacob and Joe posted a video of themselves playing Mario Wonder in a GameStop, at the very end, Joe turned the camera around to the girl filming and said, "Are you Jaden Animations?" The bit being it was our friend Sarah Moon, who is not me, but has been called Jaden by confused viewers in the past for really no reason, but still, hundreds of people in the comment section of the video still thought she was me anyway because Asian girl. Then, to poke fun at that situation, a while later they asked me to record them playing Mario Kart in a round one, and in it said, "Huge shout out to Sarah Moon for recording this video," as the camera panned to me. And you'd think people would catch on to the joke, but so many more people were like, "Okay, I thought that was Jaden in the other video, but was afraid of being racist." Not realizing they're still not getting it. Sarah and I genuinely look nothing alike. But just pointing at one of us and going, "Jaden," will convince hordes of people in comment sections without fail. It's like casting an inescapable Jaden spell. On the opposite side of the coin, I was in San Diego for TwitchCon last year, perusing the San Diego Zoo with some friends. And honestly, to hype it up a bit, the San Diego Zoo is awesome. I legit went there 3 times during the 3-day event, which, to the math nerds out there, means I went to the zoo more times than the actual convention. Anyway, someone ended up coming up to me with an "excuse me" that I registered as I was being recognized. So I turned around, expecting the typical fan interaction. "Sorry to interrupt, but are you Emeru?" I was stunlocked. It threw off my whole script and I accidentally blurted out, "Oh, no, I'm not. I'm sorry, I'm just Asian." And the guy didn't really have anything to say about that. He just went, "Oh, okay, thanks." You know, it was a nice little dose of humble for me though. I got a kick out of Emily and Sarah being called Jaden, and now I've been struck by the Emeru hammer. Look, I'll be the one to say it though. None of us look like each other. We're just Asian women on the internet, and not even the same kind. So yeah, if you ever think you see your favorite Asian creator in the wild, make sure you double check. Sometimes I can tell people are secretly Googling me before asking for a photo, just to be sure. And you know, if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. I didn't mean to go off on this whole tangent about people accidentally being racist. I'm sorry, there are just a lot of instances of it. We can get back on track now. The very first time I was recognized, not in like a convention setting, was in a random Target. I was walking down an aisle chatting with my friend Kelsey when someone passed by, backtracked, and came up asking, "Are you Jaden?" Now this was back in 2017 when I had significantly less content showing my face, so I was completely shocked and not prepared. I was in ugly house clothes, no makeup, hair wasn't washed, literal bridge dweller, and was in the middle of my first public fan interaction. Apparently, they recognized me from my voice, which is nuts. Some people have told me I sound exactly like how I do in my videos, and others say I don't, so I have no barometer on what I actually sound like. The person was super sweet. This isn't like a crazy story or anything, but it's special in my mind because I was so embarrassed and unprepared for it, mentally and physically. This next one was when Jacob, Captain Kid, and I were in Hawaii for Pokemon Worlds. We'd all just arrived at the event and were checking out all the fun decorations Pokemon set up. Since all of us have made a good amount of Pokemon content, a lot of Pokemon fans were recognized recognizing us and asking to take photos. A well-intentioned mom ended up taking notice of how much attention we were getting and asked us what we did for a living for all of these people to be coming up to us. Jacob explained we were YouTubers and she lit up, saying her son watches a lot of YouTube, pointing down at the young boy hiding behind her leg. In an attempt to connect with the kid a bit, Jacob asked what YouTubers he watched.
I like Mr. Beast.
Seeing a way to make the kid excited, Jacob pointed at me and said, "No way! Did you know she was in a Mr. Beast video recently and won?" Instantly, the kid jumped up. "You know Mr. Beast?" "Well, like, kinda. I've talked to him before, but..." "Will you tell him to give me $1 million?" First of all, hilarious situation to suddenly be thrust into. Second of all, now that the kid was suddenly not hiding behind his mom's leg anymore, we could see he had a giant gold chain around his neck, sporting a framed PSA-graded base set first edition Charizard. Little dude, do you know how much cash you've got around your neck right now? The card was graded like 9.5 as well. I have no idea where he got it from. Like, you always see those, "Can you give me $1 billion? Comments on Mr. Beast stuff. But it was surreal to witness it in real life. Like, it's real. Gold chain Charizard Mr. Beast kid has been cemented in my memories, and he didn't even know who we were. Also, for the record, after I won the Mr. Beast cube, my emails were an absolute wreck of random people begging me for money. "Can you give me money? May please get some money? Hi, JD." "Not my name. Just 10K, thank you." Heart. Someone straight up sent me a PayPal invoice for $10,000 with no message attached. Just an outstretched, grubby little hand in my inbox. Guys, I didn't win any money from that thing. You can stop emailing me. We gave it all away to various artists all over the globe to support them through their art school, which was an incredible opportunity, and I was very happy to support artists, and I wish them all the best of luck with their degrees. But stop emailing me for money! Gosh, I don't even want to know what Mr. Beast's DMs look like. One time, my phone screen died on me. Not my fault. So I had to take it to a repair shop. This was, unfortunately, during a time when my car's driver's side mirror was smashed. My fault. So I also had no street legal car to take me back home while I waited for my phone to be fixed. Needing to kill 2 hours, I ended up sitting in a nearby Burger King, equipped with my Switch to play Hello Kitty Island Adventure, and an iPad as a second monitor to watch YouTube videos. I almost made it the entire time with no issue, but like some sort of pathetic Scooby-Doo villain, my plan was foiled as a nice girl came up to me and quickly said, "I really like your videos," before walking back over to sit with her friends. Now, the interaction itself was completely fine. I'm just embarrassed at what it looked like on her end. Internet personality Jaden Animations sitting completely alone at a single seat table in a random Burger King. No food in sight, just a table covered in devices like some sort of 27-year-old iPad kid. She didn't even let me explain my situation, she just said hi and walked off. So, kind girl, if you're out there, or even still a fan, it wasn't as pathetic as it looked. It was pathetic, but it's not that bad. I was just passing the time. Please resubscribe. I feel like I lost you that day. Speaking of unfollowing out of shame, a couple years ago, I went with some friends to my first furry convention. The furry convention isn't the shameful part, though. That itself was great. The actual shame began when my group wanted to check out the 18 plus section, mainly out of curiosity and entertainment. I sheepishly followed them in, and just as I was thinking to myself, "Man, it would sure be unfortunate if I got recognized while in here." Oh my gosh, are you Jaden Animations? Yeah. So admittedly, there's a single photo out there of me, a fan, and a very colorful background. Quickly moving on from that one, this story is by far the most I've ever been recognized out in public in my entire life. There's probably a teeny little slight possibility I curated it myself by accident, but it was when I went to a Hatsune Miku concert in California. The community somehow has caught on that I like her, and said community was all right there in one spot. Before the concert, I was getting recognized, like, every few minutes, which is very not normal for me, but, you know, completely fine. I don't mind at all. Eventually, everyone was led into the venue, I was meeting a few more people inside, then the lights went down, and we all got to enjoy the concert as per usual. However, when the show was over and the lights turned back on, everyone rotated 180 degrees to head to the exit, which meant people could see my face again. We would make it a few steps forward, get stopped, then three more people would come up, and I'd suddenly be against the wall, all while my poor friends just had to watch it all happen and wait for me. For the first time ever, I needed to figure out a way to get out of there, or else I would have been taking photos with the entire concert audience as my friends withered on the floor. Sarah put her big hoodie on me, another friend gave me their sunglasses, and suddenly, I vanished. No more Jaden animations. Poof. She was gone. The Clark Kent strategy actually works. Sarah and I quickly headed to the exit, squishing past unsuspecting Miku fans, and it wasn't until we made it all the way to the parking lot where we turned around and realized we were alone. I was successfully smuggled out, but the downside was the disguise was so overly effective. Even our friends didn't know who I was anymore. At least now I know if I'm ever in a sticky situation, a simple hoodie and glasses is really all it takes. I will no longer be making fun of Superman's public disguise. Dude knew what he was talking about. Despite all of these stories, if you ever see me in public, please don't be afraid to come up and say hi. I'm more than happy to meet you or take a photo. Again, basically every person I've met who watches my videos was absolutely wonderful, these stories included. And I promise I won't make a video about you if you accidentally say something a little awkward. Unless it was really funny and the world needs to know. Also, I can tell when you recognize me, I've essentially got a spidey sense for it by now, and it's more uncomfortable for both of us if you just stare at me for 30 minutes and then leave. Please, just say hi or something. It's okay. I'm lucky to have such a normal and kind group of people watching my content, and I do really enjoy getting to meet you guys. I guess if you were to take anything from this video, make sure you know it's actually me. This is not me. This is not me. This is not me. I'm this one. Hope that helps.
Man, it has been quite some time since I've done a good old classic story time. What is this, 2016? The fact that I really only have lighthearted funny stories to share and not really any bad or scary ones with meeting people who watch the videos is a huge testament on how kind and respectful you all are, and I really appreciate it. Like, half of these stories are about how I was the one fumbling it, you know? I always look forward to meeting more of you guys in the future. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you later!